You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk Nation Radio, we remember the Christmas truce, or I should say truces, of 1914, 15, and 16. Most famously in 1914, both sides in the trenches in World War I stopped trying to kill each other for a day because it happened to be a holiday, Christmas, and made friends and played games and talked with each other and exchanged items and the next day went back to trying to kill each other again. If you go to my website, davidswanson.org/Christmas Truce, you'll find links to music videos and full-length films and books and fiction and nonfiction and first-person accounts and photographs of the truce. And one man named Bruce Bairnsfather, who was a British cartoonist and humorist and writer as well as a soldier who was there in 1914, who was photographed there, wrote about it. And a chapter in his book, Bullets and Billets, chapter 8, was called Christmas Eve, A Lull in Hate, Britain cum Bosch. And I'd like to read that chapter for you. Shortly after the doing set forth in the previous chapter, we left the trenches for our usual day in billets. It was now nearing Christmas Day, and we knew it would fall to our lot to be back in the trenches again on the 23rd of December, and that we would, in consequence, spend our Christmas there. I remember at the time being very down on my luck about this, as anything in the nature of Christmas Day festivities was obviously knocked on the head. Now, however, looking back on it all, I wouldn't have missed that unique and weird Christmas Day for anything. Well, as I said before, we went in again on the 23rd. The weather had now become very fine and cold. The dawn of the 24th brought a perfectly still, cold, frosty day. The spirit of Christmas began to permeate us all. We tried to plot ways and means of making the next day, Christmas, different in some way to others. Invitations from one dugout to another for sundry meals were beginning to circulate. Christmas Eve was, in the way of weather, everything that Christmas Eve should be. I was billed to appear at a dugout about a quarter of a mile to the left that evening to have rather a special thing in trench dinners, not quite so bully and menacushy about as usual. A bottle of red wine and a medley of tinned things from home deputized in their absence. The day had been entirely free from shelling, and somehow we all felt that the Bosches, too, wanted to be quiet. There was a kind of an invisible, intangible feeling extending across the frozen swamp between the two lines, which said, "This is Christmas Eve for both of us. Something in common." About 10 p.m. I made my exit from the convivial dugout on the left of our line and walked back to my own lair. On arriving at my own bit of trench, I found several of the men standing about and all very cheerful. There was a good bit of singing and talking going on, jokes and jibes on our curious Christmas Eve, as contrasted with any former one, were thick in the air. One of my men turned to me and said, "You can hear 'em quite plain, sir." "Hear what?" I inquired. "The Germans over there, sir. Hear 'em singing and playing on a band or something." I listened away out across the field among the dark shadows beyond. I could hear the murmur of voices, and an occasional burst of some unintelligible song would come floating out on the frosty air. The singing seemed to be loudest and most distinct a bit to our right. I popped into my dugout and found the platoon commander. "Do you hear the Bosches kicking up that racket over there?" I said. "Yes," he replied. "They've been at it some time." "Come on," said I. "Let's go along the trench to the hedge there on the right. That's the nearest point to them over there." So we stumbled along our now hard frosted ditch and, scrambling up on the bank above, strode across the field to our next bit of trench on the right. Everyone was listening. an improvised Bosch band was playing a precarious version of Deutschland, Deutschland über alles, at the conclusion of which some of our mouth organ experts retaliated with snatches of ragtime songs and imitations of the German tune. Suddenly we heard a confused shouting from the other side. We all stopped to listen. The shout came again. A voice in the darkness shouted in English with a strong German accent, "Come over here!" A ripple of mirth swept along our trench, followed by a rude outburst of mouth organs and laughter. Presently, in a lull, one of our sergeants repeated the request, "Come over here!" "You come halfway, I come halfway," floated out of the darkness. "Come on, then," shouted the sergeant. "I'm coming along the hedge." "Ah, but there are two of you," came back the voice from the other side. Well, anyway, after much suspicious shouting and jocular derision from both sides, our sergeant went along the hedge, which ran at right angles to the two lines of trenches. He was quickly out of sight. But as we all listened in breathless silence, we soon heard a spasmodic conversation taking place out there in the darkness. Presently the sergeant returned. He had with him a few German cigars and cigarettes, which he had exchanged for a couple of menakeshes and a tin of capstan, which he had taken with him. The seance was over, but it had given just the requisite touch to our Christmas Eve, something a little human and out of the ordinary routine. After months of vindictive sniping and shelling, this little episode came as an invigorating tonic and a welcome relief to the daily monotony of antagonism. It did not lessen our ardor or determination, but just put a little human punctuation mark in our lives of cold and humid hate. Just on the right day, too, Christmas Eve. But as a curious episode, this was nothing in comparison to our experience on the following day. On Christmas morning, I awoke very early and emerged from my dugout into the trench. It was a perfect day, a beautiful cloudless blue sky, the ground hard and white, fading off towards the wood in a low, thin, low-lying mist. It was such a day as is invariably depicted by artists on Christmas cards, the ideal Christmas day of fiction. Fancy all this hate, war, and discomfort on a day like this, I thought to myself. The whole spirit of Christmas seemed to be there, so much so that I remember thinking, this indescribable something in the air, this peace and goodwill feeling, surely will have some effect on the situation here today. And I wasn't far wrong. It did around us anyway, and I have always been so glad to think of my luck in firstly being actually in the trenches on Christmas Day, and secondly, being on the spot where quite a unique little episode took place. Everything looked merry and bright that morning. The discomforts seemed to be less somehow. They seemed to have epitomized themselves in intense frosty cold. It was just the sort of day for peace to be declared. It would have made such a good finale. I should like to have suddenly heard an immense siren blowing. Everybody to stop and say, "What was that?" Siren blowing again. Appearance of a small figure running across the frozen mud waving something. He gets closer. A telegraph boy with a wire. He hands it to me. With trembling fingers, I open it. "War off. Return home. George, R.I. Cheers, but no, it was a nice fine day, that was all. Walking about the trench a little later, discussing the curious affair of the night before, we suddenly became aware of the fact that we were seeing a lot of evidences of Germans. Heads were bobbing about and showing over their parapet in a most reckless way, and as we looked, this phenomenon became more and more pronounced. A complete Bosch figure suddenly appeared on the parapet and looked about itself. This complaint became infectious. It didn't take our Bert long to be up on the skyline. It is one long grind to ever keep him off it. This was the signal for more Bosch anatomy to be disclosed, and this was replied to by all our Alfs and Bills until, in less time than it takes to tell, half a dozen or so of each of the belligerents were outside their trenches and were advancing towards each other in no man's land. A strange sight, truly. I clambered up and over our parapet and moved across the field to look. Clad in a muddy suit of khaki and wearing a sheepskin coat and balaclava helmet, I joined the throng about halfway across to the German trenches. It all felt most curious. Here were these sausage-eating wretches who had elected to start this infernal European fracas, and in so doing had brought us all into the same muddy pickle as themselves. This was my first real sight of them at close quarters. Here they were, the actual practical soldiers of the German army. There was not an atom of hate on either side that day. And yet on our side, not for a moment was the will to war and the will to beat them relaxed. It was just like the interval between the rounds in a friendly boxing match. The difference in type between our men and theirs was very marked. There was no contrasting the spirit of the two parties. Our men in their scratch costumes of dirty, muddy khaki, with their various assorted headdresses of woolen helmets, mufflers, and battered hats, were a light-hearted, open, humorous collection as opposed to the somber demeanor and stolid appearance of the Huns in their gray-green, faded uniforms, top boots, and pork-pie hats. The shortest effect I can give of the impression I had was that our men, superior, broad-minded, more frank and lovable beings, were regarding these faded, unimaginative products of perverted culture as a set of objectionable but amusing lunatics whose heads had got to be eventually smacked. "Look at that one over there, Bill," our Bert would say, as he pointed out some particularly curious member of the party. I strolled about amongst them all and sucked in as many impressions as I could. Two or three of the Boches seemed to be particularly interested in me, and after they had walked round me once or twice, with sullen curiosity stamped on their faces, one came up and said, "Officer?" I nodded my head, which means yes in most languages, and besides, I can't talk German. These devils I could see all wanted to be friendly, but none of them possessed the open, frank geniality of our men. However, everyone was talking and laughing and souvenir hunting. I spotted a German officer, some sort of lieutenant, I should think, and being a bit of a collector, I intimated to him that I had taken a fancy to some of his buttons. We both then said things to each other which neither understood and agreed to do a swap. I brought out my wire clippers and, with a few deft snips, removed a couple of his buttons and put them in my pocket. I then gave him two of mine in exchange. Whilst this was going on, a babbling of guttural ejaculations emanating from one of the lagershifters told me that some idea had occurred to someone. Suddenly one of the Boches ran back to his trench and presently reappeared with a large camera. I posed in a mixed group of several photographs and have ever since wished I had fixed up some arrangement for getting a copy. No doubt framed editions of this photograph are reposing on some Hun mantelpiece, showing clearly and unmistakably to admiring strafers how a group of perfidious English surrendered unconditionally on Christmas Day to the brave Deutschers. Slowly the meeting began to disperse, a sort of feeling that the authorities on both sides were not very enthusiastic about this fraternizing seemed to creep across the gathering. We parted, but there was a distinct and friendly understanding that Christmas Day would be left to finish in tranquility. The last I saw of this little affair was a vision of one of my machine gunners, who was a bit of an amateur hairdresser in civil life, cutting the unnaturally long hair of a docile Boche who was patiently kneeling on the ground whilst the automatic clippers crept up the back of his neck. That's an account, not of perfect harmony and understanding, but of a pause in mass murder. And why shouldn't we take as many such pauses as possible? There's been a proposal for an Olympics truce this coming Winter Olympics. There's been a proposal from a peace organization for a year without war in the year 2020. To the extent that such things are achieved, the lesson presumably, as has been the lesson from the Christmas truces of World War I, ought to be, why not continue the truce forever? If you can have a truce, why end it? If you can stop a fit of mass madness, why resume it again? So these Christmas truces in World War I happened in more than one location and more than one year. Another account of another one that happened in 1914 in a book by Frank Richards called Old Soldiers Never Die from 1933 has this first-person account from Frank Richards. On Christmas morning, we stuck up a board with a Merry Christmas on it. The enemy had stuck up a similar one. Platoons would sometimes go out for 24 hours rest. It was a day at least out of the trench and relieved the monotony a bit. And my platoon had gone out of its way the night before, but a few of us stayed behind to see what would happen. Two of our men then threw their equipment off and jumped on the parapet with their hands above their heads. Two of the Germans done the same and commenced to walk up the riverbank. Our two men going to meet them. They met and shook hands, and then we all got out of the trench. Buffalo Bill, the company commander, rushed into the trench and endeavored to prevent it, but he was too late. The whole of the company were now out, and so were the Germans. He had to accept the situation, so soon he and the other company officers climbed out too. We and the Germans met in the middle of no man's land. Their officers was also out now. Our officers exchanged greetings with them. One of the German officers said that he wished he had a camera to take a snapshot, but they were not allowed to carry cameras. Neither were our officers. We mucked in all day with one another. They were Saxons, and some of them could speak English. By the look of them, their trenches were in as bad a state as our own. One of their men, speaking in English, mentioned that he had worked in Brighton for some years and that he was fed up to the neck with this damned war and would be glad when it was all over. We told him that he wasn't the only one that was fed up with it. We did not allow them in our trench, and they did not allow us in theirs. The German company commander asked Buffalo Bill if he would accept a couple of barrels of beer and assured him that they would not make his men drunk. They had plenty of it in the brewery. He accepted the offer with thanks, and a couple of their men rolled the barrels over, and we took them into our trench. The German officer sent one of his men back to the trench, who appeared shortly after, carrying a tray with bottles and glasses on it. Officers of both sides clinked glasses and drunk one another's health. Buffalo Bill had presented them with a plum pudding just before. The officers came to an understanding that the unofficial truce would end at midnight. At dusk, we went back to our respective trenches. The two barrels of beer were drunk, and the German officer was right. If it was possible for a man to have drunk the two barrels himself, he would have bursted before he had got drunk. French beer was rotten stuff. Just before midnight, we all made it up not to commence firing before they did. At night, there was always plenty of firing by both sides if there were no working parties or patrols out. Mr. Richardson, a young officer who had just joined the battalion and was now a platoon officer in my company, wrote a poem during the night about the Briton and the Boche meeting in No Man's Land on Christmas Day, which he read out to us. A few days later, it was published in the Times or Morning Post, I believe. During the whole of Boxing Day, the day after Christmas, we never fired a shot, and they the same. Each side seemed to be waiting for the other to set the ball a-rolling. One of their men shouted across in English and inquired how we had enjoyed the beer. We shouted back and told him it was very weak, but that we were very grateful for it. We were conversing off and on during the whole of the day. We were relieved that evening at dusk by a battalion of another brigade. We were mighty surprised, as we had heard no whisper of any relief during the day. We told the men who relieved us how we had spent the last couple of days with the enemy, and they told us that by what they had been told, the whole of the British troops in the line, with one or two exceptions, had mucked in with the enemy. They had only been out of action themselves 48 hours after being 28 days in the front-line trenches. They also told us that the French people had heard how we had spent Christmas Day and were saying all manner of nasty things about the British Army. And that is Frank Richards' account of a truce that happened because it was Christmas and perhaps is known to us because it was Christmas, and it makes a good story. But truces have happened in many, many wars, including wars that are ongoing and could happen today and could continue tomorrow and could be made never to end. Again, at davidswanson.org/Christmas Truce, you will find all kinds of resources, including dramas, that plays that can be performed by you and your friends reenacting the Christmas truces of World War I, links to music, including Garth Brooks' song Bella Wood, and probably my favorite, John McCutcheon's song, Christmas in the Trenches. I have not found a John McCutcheon version of his own song that is available to be played on my show without permission, but I have found a terrific version of it that's licensed in the Creative Commons by Thomas Burby. So here is John McCutcheon's Christmas in the Trenches.
Francis Tolliver, come from Liverpool. 2 years ago, the war was waiting for me after school. From Belgium and to Flanders, from Germany to here, I fought for king and country I love dear. 'Twas Christmas in the trenches. Frost so bitter hung, the frozen fields of France were still, no songs of peace were sung. Our families back in England were toasting us that day, the brave and glorious lads so far away. I was lying with my messmate on the cold and rocky ground, when across the lines of battle came a most peculiar sound. Says I, now listen up, me boys, each soldier strained to hear, as one young German voice sang out so clear. He's singing bloody well, you know, my partner says to me. Soon one by one each German voice joined in harmony. The cannons all were silent, the gas clouds rolled no more, as Christmas brought us respite from the war. Finished, and the reverend pause was spent, God rest you, merry gentlemen, struck up some lad from Kent. Well, the next they sang was steely knocked, 'tis silent night, says I, and in two tongues one song filled up that sky. There's someone coming towards us, the frontline sentry cried, and all sights were fixed on one lone figure trudging from their side. His truce flag, like a Christmas star, shone on that plain so bright, as he bravely strolled unarmed into the night. Then one by one on either side, we walked into no man's land. With neither gun nor bayonet, we met there hand to hand. We shared some secret brandy, and we wished each other well. And in a flare-lit soccer game, we gave them hell. We traded chocolates, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Young Sanders played his squeeze box, and they had a violin. This curious and unlikely band of men. Soon daylight stole upon us. France was France once more. With sad farewells we each began to settle back to war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sights? 'Twas Christmas in the trenches, where the frost so bitter hung. But the frozen fields of France were warmed as Christmas songs were sung. For the walls they'd kept between us to exact the work of war had been crumbled and were gone forevermore. Oh, my name is Francis Tolliver. In Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas comes since World War I, I've learned its lessons well. That the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame. And on each end of the rifle, we're the same.
That's Thomas Burby's cover of John McCutcheon's wonderful song, Christmas in the Trenches. Of course, sadly, the participants did, for the most part, go right back to trying to kill each other the day after Christmas or within 2 days. But those in charge of the armies on both sides of those trenches saw a danger and in many cases removed groups of men and punished leaders of truces and sought to restore dependable willingness to kill without respite. They saw a danger, and we should see a hope that people participating in war, signing up for war, supporting war, paying taxes for war, cheering for war, might take a break, might say peace on earth, and put some meaning behind those words, and put an end to the endless weapons-dealing and war-provoking and war-threatening and planet-risking behavior that has become normalized in the century since World War I. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next. Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the Supreme Court has okayed full implementation of Donald Trump's Muslim travel ban, despite the fact that its constitutionality is still being challenged in lower courts, despite the fact that even the Department of Homeland Security reports show no relationship between the targeted countries and national security threats. And despite the fact that Trump gives the lie to the White House assertion that the ban isn't anti-Muslim every time he opens his mouth. With so many facts being spited, you'd hope journalists would step up in defense of the immediately affected people and of the democratic process. We'll talk about the Muslim ban with Suman Raghunathan, executive director of SALT, South Asian Americans Leading Together. Also on the show, Don Blankenship is the kind of guy who, when the mining company he runs is polluting the local water, will run a private pipeline over to the next town for his own home. And the kind of guy who, having been convicted of conspiring to break mine safety laws, leading to an explosion that killed 29 men, emerges from prison and announces a run for Senate. You might chuckle, but Blankenship's confident recourse to big lie politics, he alleges his conviction was a state conspiracy, stands a better chance with an establishment press corps whose fears of partisanship make them hesitate to check lies with adequate force. We will have a reminder of Don Blankenship's record in a 2016 interview on the subject with attorney Bruce Stanley. That's coming up, but first, a very quick look back at recent press. Reporting the news can be punished as criminal conspiracy, Federal Judge Lynn Leibovitz said at the so-called J-20 trial in Washington, D.C., where journalists and protesters alike are being prosecuted for property damage they didn't commit during the Trump inauguration. According to an account by The Real News' Baynard Woods, Leibovitz's discussion of the motions for a judgment of acquittal singled out defendant Alexei Wood, an independent journalist who was live streaming the January 20th protests. With respect to Mr. Wood, a reasonable juror could find that he was a principal and an aider and abettor of the riot, Leibovitz said. Yes, he was there filming. There is no evidence in the record that that was for a purpose inconsistent with participation in the riot. She added, he played a role that furthered the purposes both of the conspiracy and of the riot itself, which was to advertise it, to broadcast it, to live stream it, such that others could be recruited to join in. Persons hearing his live stream could be recruited and were being kept abreast and informed of the events, Leibovitz said, pretty much defining the work of journalism. So if as a journalist you inform people about illegal activities, you may be found guilty of committing those activities, unless in a reversal of the usual burden of proof in criminal cases, you can provide evidence that you were reporting for a purpose inconsistent with participation. Well, that's a judicial position that ought to strike fear into the heart of every journalist. But The Real News is Woods was, as far as we could find, the only reporter to have covered Lynn Leibovitz's First Amendment threatening analysis. Outlets like The Washington Post, for whom both the protests and the trial are local stories, were content, in this case, to let democracy die in darkness. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The fact that candidate Donald Trump called for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States and that President Donald Trump calls for a ban on Muslims entering the United States. The latest version blocks people from 8 countries, 6 of them Muslim majority, presents a question for journalists. How credulously do you treat the White House claim that the ban isn't about religion? You would think it wouldn't be a hard question, and yet, as John Alsop at Columbia Journalism Review noted, a number of media who referred to a Muslim ban when it was first introduced have been seen to be blanding things out now to travel ban. The Supreme Court's December 4th decision to allow Muslim Ban 3.0, as it's been dubbed, to be implemented, even as challenges to its constitutionality make their way through the courts, certainly risks normalizing, legitimizing the ban in the public eye, making media scrutiny of the policy that much more critical. Joining us now to talk about these issues is Suman Raghunathan, Executive Director of SALT, South Asian Americans Leading Together. Welcome to Counterspin, Suman Raghunathan.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here.
It's not simply a matter of a ban or a no ban. There are other discriminatory policies and there are other real world effects of this kind of government legitimizing, if you will, of discrimination.
Absolutely, Janine. I mean, we cannot underestimate the impact of codifying discrimination and deepening a separation between those who are Muslim, Middle Eastern, Arab, South Asian, and the rest of the country. SALT has been looking at hate violence and indeed the relationship between hate violence and xenophobic political rhetoric for the better part of a decade. And what we've seen increasingly over the last several years has been an increasingly deep and intertwined relationship between xenophobic political rhetoric and its impact to really spur and encourage hate violence. You know, for several years, we weren't able to draw a direct relationship between the two, and we're very careful to not do so because we didn't yet have enough data. And yet, in the last year to 18 months, we've seen an increasing number of studies that really bear out the relationship that SALT has been suspecting for quite some time, which is that when our elected and appointed officials and those who aspire to be elected and appointed officials poison the nation's political debate and our national conversation on communities, indeed our communities, which is an incredibly diverse spectrum of folks in this country, right? So they include South Asian, Muslim, Arab, Christian, Middle Eastern communities. But we have individuals who call into question the very place and viability and protections afforded to all of those folks in the country, then we know that that indeed spurs violence against our communities. You know, we're in the process of finalizing an analysis of hate violence and xenophobic political rhetoric since the election, right? So roughly over the last year.
Right.
And what we've increasingly found is an even deeper relationship between the policies and views espoused by President Trump and those of his administration and acts of violence against our communities, which are reaching levels that we only saw in the year immediately after the events of September 11th. We're seeing over a 50% increase in the number of documented hate violence incidents since the November 2016 presidential election relative to the previous year. So the level of violence and the surging tide of violence really spurred by, encouraged by, and enabled by the views and political rhetoric coming out of this administration and of policymakers is really contributing to an increasingly problematic and toxic discourse at a national level about our communities. South Asians are the most rapidly growing demographic group in this country. And we're not only growing in places like California and New York and New Jersey, but we're growing in places like Texas. We're growing in places like Alabama. We're growing in places like Florida that have had a much more fraught national history on race. And so it's really throwing our communities and the actual physical safety of many of our community members straight into a maelstrom of policies that are very much in line with those of a resurgent white supremacist movement in this country. It means something when David Duke applauds explicitly anti-Muslim tweets from the president, and that's sending a message, indeed, to many individuals in the white supremacist movement in this country that their views and their actions are indeed believed in, echoed by, and implicitly supported by those who should do better.
Well, let's move on just to the resistance, finally. What do you see as the most effective ways for people to resist these attacks on community? And what role do journalists or does media play in that?
Well, let me take the answers to that question in reverse order.
Sure.
So you I think, referred to in the setup as well, the important role that media has played to really soften the blow or the impact of what is a Muslim ban, to refer to as a travel ban. I think it's crucial that in particular journalists really put a priority to understanding and really covering on the ground the impact of these patently discriminatory policies, which are, to be clear, not only policies or attacks against Muslim, Arab, and South Asian American communities, but are really wholesale attacks on immigrants as well as communities of color writ large.
Right.
The decision to end DACA and the intransigence on the part of Congress to enact the DREAM Act, which would make a huge difference for, of course, nearly 800,000 undocumented Dreamers, but would include a significant share of South Asians, right? I think all of these dynamics and policies have a tremendous impact on communities on the ground. And it's crucial that journalists not only call a spade, particularly around drawing a connection between the explicit aims and goals of restrictionists and of white supremacists who are currently occupying and have occupied positions of power in this administration, but are also really connecting the dots between those policies and their impact on the ground.
Right. Right.
I also think, you know, that we, in terms of the resistance, we have seen a tremendous amount of resistance, right? The reality on the part of organizers and grassroots communities that all of these attacks are attacks on all of us has been an incredibly inspiring and hopeful reminder of the need for us to build strong coalitions and of the need to continue to call out not only the administration, but also of those who are informing the administration's efforts to explicitly target our communities.
We've been speaking with Suman Raghunathan, Executive Director of South Asian Americans Leading Together. You can find their work, including their statement in response to the Supreme Court's recent decision, on their site, saalt.org. Suman Raghunathan, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Twenty-nine men died April 5, 2010, in an explosion at Upper Big Branch Mine in Montcoal, West Virginia. The mine was run by Massey Energy, and Massey Energy was run by Don Blankenship. A looming regional figure whose tight control over his workplace was notorious, Blankenship racked up profits and political capital, along with safety violations, while saying cartoon villainous things like, quote, "I don't care what people think. At the end of the day, Don Blankenship is going to die with more money than he needs." Close quote. Blankenship was convicted in December 2016 of conspiring to violate federal mine safety standards and sentenced to the maximum penalty, 1 year in prison, along with a fine and a year of supervised release. Released from prison early this year, Blankenship has run TV ads calling himself a political prisoner, claimed that the Mine Safety and Health Administration actually caused the disaster at Upper Big Branch, and lately declared he's running for U.S. Senate. Scoff you may, but elite media may not prove as critical of this hubristic reinvention as we would hope. On the occasion of Blankenship's conviction, Counterspin spoke with attorney Bruce Stanley. He's represented people combating coal and chemical companies for decades, and the story of his and colleague Dave Fawcett's many-year legal battle with Blankenship and Massey Energy was the subject of the book The Price of Justice by Lawrence Leamer. Here's some of that April 2016 conversation.
News accounts note that this conviction is the first time such a high-ranking executive has been convicted of a workplace safety violation. And I guess my question is, why is that? It can't be the first time that one has been guilty of one.
That's certainly a fair statement. I think in this particular circumstance, there's a long history of Blankenship actions in the coal fields of West Virginia that, with the culmination of the explosion of Upper Big Branch, ultimately law enforcement and prosecutors at the federal level had to say enough is enough and had to move. It's important for your listeners to remember that while 29 died on that April day 6 years ago, a total of more than 53 men died in coal mines operated under Blankenship's leadership from the time the company was a publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange, going back to 2000. I had worked on the Aracoma mine fire, which one of the cases Mr. Leamer talks about in his book, and we were almost offended by the lack of action by the prosecutor's office on the criminal front in that case, and let the federal judge who accepted the plea bargain in that case, which resulted in a plea of 11 misdemeanor counts and one felony count against the operating subsidiary company only. He allowed that plea bargain to go forward despite the fact that prosecutors had said as a part of that agreement that they would not look upstairs. They would not look at the executive offices of Massey. And so we urged that it be rejected, and unfortunately it was not. And in our view of things, that was the equivalent of a get-out-of-jail-free card for Don Blankenship, an unintentional approval of the way he had conducted business to pass. And in my estimation, one of the very reasons we ended up with that with 29 dead miners 6 years ago.
Before the federal jury conviction of Blankenship in December, we were hearing about maybe 31 years he might serve, and that was because of these other counts on which he was not ultimately convicted about lying to regulators. He was only convicted on this misdemeanor count, which is why we're looking at this one-year maximum sentence. But you're getting at, why did that not happen? And that has to do with politics. You know, I mean, we think it's a legal question about corporate crime and what legal tools we have. But of course, who the judges are, who's deciding the cases, all of that is very political. So let me then move you on to, you're saying the backbone needs to be at the local level to bring these charges and to allow them to move up. Where do local media come in there? Because it seems to me that public outrage, public concern, and public knowledge are dependent to some extent on reporters getting that story out and making that an urgent story. So what can you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's true enough. I mean, I was a local reporter on a small southern West Virginia newspaper out of college, and I appreciated the strain that one would feel when making decisions about whether or not to write stories about certain local, quote, powerful local officials. I mean, that pressure on local media is palpable. And unless there is an independent media there, the notion of some young prosecutor or any prosecutor standing up and saying, hey, enough's enough and we need to take an independent stand here, it calls for a conviction that, frankly, most average citizens don't possess. And when you weigh that against the economics of a local economy, a single engine economy, it gets very difficult. A lot of these miners' families who complain about the safety issues associated with operating in a Massey mine, many of those same families were the ones who are complaining about the alleged war on coal, where coal is saying, hey, we're being regulated out of business by the Obama administration. So it becomes a very, very difficult dynamic. I think it's also important to remember, though, and I do want to revisit quickly the nature of the federal charges that he was charged against.
Mm-hmm.
That is not local. That is something that the national politicians could do something about. That's something that the Congress of the United States has had on its desk for some time now and has chosen not to act. And that's a choice not to act as a lack of leadership from Washington representatives from the coalfields. Shelley Capito and Joe Manchin and Mitch McConnell all represent constituents who are laboring in unsafe mine conditions where, that one-year maximum penalty is all that's out there. They can change that anytime that they want. The administration would back that change, and they know that, and they choose not to. And so that one, is very problematic when weighed against what you know is going to be the inertia at the local setting because of the overall power of coal in these communities, what they could be doing with a stroke of a pen, essentially, at the national level to prevent that. Why should it be that it's 30 years to lie to Wall Street, 1 year to conspire to violate the mine laws, safety laws of the United States? And that's a choice that Congress has made.
Well, let me ask you this. CNN's Anderson Cooper was talking about Upper Big Branch, and he said, "It's a kind of accident that isn't supposed to happen anymore." I often think that media are most telling in their kind of offhand comments, and that to me was telling. I'm not even let me imagine I know what he thinks he means there, wasn't supposed to happen anymore. But the reality is miner deaths and workplace deaths are not a historical artifact. These are things that happen every day. And part of the media kind of misunderstanding has to do with thinking that they're rare, that they're unusual, and that they're from the past.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. As I said earlier, 53 men at least died under Don Blankenship's watch. We watched Upper Big Branch because 29 died in one spectacularly stupid explosion. But, there are another 20 miner, or so underground, one or two at a time, dying because of the same management style, the same sense of dollars over men, the same sense of production over safety that accounted for Upper Big Branch. There's a fatalism. I can best think of it in terms of, for me, there's a fatalism in the Appalachian community that drove me crazy and continues to drive me crazy. And that is that, well, some things, basically you just got to put, this is the lot we have in life. This is the hand God dealt us. Sometimes you just got to put up with things and deal with it. That's bull. The laws are on the books. There are inspectors there to enforce the law, and there should be prosecution for the people who disobey the law. End of story. If that becomes the rubric, if that becomes the way in which we conduct ourselves as a society, then hopefully we will get to the point where the Upper Big Branches or the Aracomas or, the mangled arms and twisted limbs and broken backs are things of the past. But put it off as, sometimes I just like to think that, I get concerned that we think that, I can turn off the TV and it goes away. Well, it doesn't go away. It's there. And it's not going to go away until that step after step, step by step, mechanical effort is undertaken to get the law in place and enforce the law, period.
Well, just one more question in a positive direction, because I think Appalachia could be a rich source of news stories. Right now the coverage is almost a curiosity, Look at these people loving this industry that's killing them. It could be the source of really transformative stories about how do we transition out of fossil fuels? How do we help the people and the communities that have been bound up with these industries, and how do we do it in a human way? I just wonder, if you're talking to journalists, what would you like to see them pursue? What are some stories you would like to see them cover, get into, investigate, that could provide a different kind of aspect on this story?
In many ways, and this will sound foreign to a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, but in many ways, what Appalachia right now is a microcosm of America. You know, it's always just been more raw down there. It's always been more up against it. And there is a transformational change going on in that region as the world evolves in its energy policies and otherwise, that really is going to put a culture through a meat grinder, so to speak. And it's the first and best opportunity that we have in the States, it seems to me, to look at what's going on and saying, if we can get beneath and understand and report and effectively describe for the people of this country, as well as the policymakers and decision makers of this country, how these forces are at work, and take it that next level, get past the superficial, get past the stereotype, and try to get to the actual mechanics of what's happening economically and politically down there through this transitional time, it's a roadmap for all of us for the future, because inevitably all of us are going to face that.
That was attorney Bruce Stanley talking with Counterspin from Pittsburgh in April 2016 about Don Blankenship. Blankenship now, as Mother Jones' Tim Murphy describes, going to great lengths to change the narrative about the events surrounding his conviction. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find those on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network and to show support for the work if you're so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
People can deny climate change, but just like King Canute of old, nobody can stop the rising seas. Author and journalist Jeff Goodall tells all in his new book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Jeff Goodall is a journalist's journalist. I've read his work for years in places like Rolling Stone magazine. In the earliest days of this program, in 2006, I interviewed Jeff for his book, Big Coal. He's also the author of How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering, and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate. Jeff Goodall, welcome back to Radio EcoShock after all these years.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Rising seas is the biggest story ever reported. Could that be true?
The biggest story ever reported? I don't know, but it's certainly going to reshape our world in very profound ways that I kind of try to grapple with a little bit in this book.
Well, on Radio EcoShock, we've run a series of interviews on growing heat deaths, with more to come. It seems like climate change, rising seas, and killer heat are in a race for public attention. How do you see the importance and impact of these two climate sides of the picture, if you will?
Well, you know, as you know, climate change is going to have and is already having lots of different impacts in different ways. You know, compared to killer heat waves, which are very much a, you know, obviously people die during killer heat waves. It's a very much a story about human mortality and the things that we can do to mitigate that to the degree that we can with better housing, better air conditioning, better all kinds of ways of dealing with heat. Sea level rise is really a story about infrastructure and about housing and real estate. And ultimately, of course, people will have to move from the coast. But the real risk for sea level rise has to do with is kind of an economic risk about the kind of incredible economic damage that will be caused in places like Miami and Texas and New York and Boston. Of course, it will have big human impacts in places like Bangladesh and Africa, which I talked about in my book. But the economics of it are going to be really devastating.
People can die from sea level rise in the sense of storm surge. We saw it with Hurricane Sandy, where the waters just rushed in. I think that's probably the only really fast implication of sea level rise that I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, and it's really an important point. I mean, sea level rise makes storm surges, makes hurricanes more deadly because as the seas get higher, that just is, you know, piled on top of whatever storm surge is coming in. So if you have 3 feet of sea level rise, you're going to have a 3 foot bigger storm surge. And that can change, you know, a 9 foot storm surge into a 12 foot storm surge, which has huge, huge implications.
I'm wondering, Jeff, did you happen to read Dr. Peter Ward's book, The Flooded Earth, Our Future in a World Without Ice Caps?
I did. I read it a whole bunch of books and I did read that one. Yes.
Yeah. Pretty good. Well, look, sea level rise, that term, it kind of assumes that there's just one thing, but in fact, there are several different aspects to this, and I'd like to dive into them with you, as I'm sure you do in your book. One of those things is going to be the way that sea level affects agriculture. You get an extra dose of seawater. They call it seawater intrusion, I guess. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that's a really big problem that it's good of you to bring up and often goes unnoticed. So one of the first things that happens in many places that have sort of a porous aquifer, a freshwater aquifer, including places like South Florida, Bangladesh, the Pacific Island states that have a lot of agriculture, is that the saltwater gets into either directly into the fields by flooding, you know, the lowlands. And as we all know, salt water is devastating for all kinds of crops. You basically can't grow crops with even small amounts of salt in the water. But it also is very troubling when you get saltwater intrusions into the aquifers under that are used for irrigation. So it doesn't have to literally flood the ground. It can just small amounts of salt water intruding into the underground aquifers render those aquifers basically unusable for agriculture. So one of the things that you're going to see happening as we even get modest levels of sea level rise, and it's in fact already happening in the Pacific Islands, is the salinization of freshwater aquifers, which has huge implications for agriculture and, of course, for drinking water also.
Well, we don't have to head very far over to the Pacific to find that. I've been reading about saltwater intrusion into the Central Valley agricultural system stretching all the way from San Francisco up to Sacramento, and what's happening there is that the farmers have pumped out so much groundwater that that's allowing the seawater to start to come in, and it will start to affect food production in America's food basket.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's exactly what's going on there. You know, the Delta region of California is one place that not a lot of people associate with sea level rise because it's, you know, relatively far from the actual coast, but that's one of the things that happens as the water rises. It pushes back into deltas and into rivers. And in fact, Sacramento, California, which is in the middle of the state, is one of the cities that's most at risk from sea level rise because of this backup of water through the Delta region.
Bizarre to think about, really. So Dr. James Hansen, he's the former head of NASA's Goddard Space Center, the person who really warned us about climate change back in 1988. He is now saying we face several meters, more than 9 feet higher seas by the end of this century. That sounds incredible. What do you think?
Well, that paper is very controversial. You know, a lot of scientists have been working hard to are skeptical of it. Jim Hansen, I've spoken with him many times and have a huge amount of respect for him. And he's one of the few scientists that are sort of willing to go out there and kind of talk openly and publish openly about science that is sort of on, you know, the sort of real forefront and are more speculative than what other scientists feel comfortable with. And, you know, Jim Hansen has often been proven right about this stuff. So I'm certainly not going to say that, you know, I just think that those numbers have to be proven out. But you don't even have to go that far. I mean, even NOAA, the top science agency, government science agency in the United States, is talking about a high end of 7 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. And, of course, it doesn't stop there. The end of the century is just one marker. It will continue to rise for centuries after that. So, you know, and one of the things that's really important about sea level rise to grasp is that, unlike other impacts of climate change, it's a sure thing. We know that even if we cut carbon emissions right now, go to zero right now, we can affect the long-term trajectory of sea level rise, but there's so much heat already built up in the oceans, and there's so much inertia that the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica are going to melt, and we're going to have sea level rise. So it's something we have to prepare for.
You know, it's interesting on the Hansen thing. I just interviewed Pankaj Khanna from Rice University in Texas. They were looking at coral reefs that had been going extinct over periods of time, and they were able to find out that, in fact, sea level rise doesn't or didn't in the past happen in slow little increments the way the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change always shows them on the graphs, but in fact went up like a meter or even 2 meters in a decade to two decades. That happened in the past, and the corals just drowned. So, you know, there's some strange things that are possible, and I think we need to talk about what is possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point, that people think of sea level rise as this long, slow, gradual thing that, you know, maybe their grandchildren have to worry about or something like that, and it moves in this slow curve. But in fact, our geologic past shows us that sea levels have risen in these very dramatic pulses. One period, 125,000 years ago, sea levels rose 13 feet in a single century. That's over a foot a decade, which if we got anything like that in our world right now, it would, of course, be devastating, totally devastating to coastal cities around the world. And the big question for geologists is, what was the mechanism that caused that? How did we get to these big pulses? And, you know, one of the things they're looking at is the instability of the big ice sheets in West Antarctica, which are situated on the sort of bowl at the edge of West Antarctica. And there's more and more evidence that, you know, these huge ice sheets, which some of which are 2 miles thick, could actually begin to kind of collapse into the sea at a very rapid rate. And because of the geology there, it's very different than it is in Greenland. And a number of scientists are beginning to think that these ice sheets in West Antarctica may have been what triggered some of these big pulses in sea level rise before and could do it again.
And scientists and policy experts talk about a global mean rise in sea levels. But, Jeff, is it going to be evenly distributed, like a fair dose for everybody?
No, it's not. That's, again, another really great point. So people think of sea level rise, and you know, I talk about these numbers of 2 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, whatever that is, as if it's just a bathtub that's filling up. But it's not. The sea level rise is, in fact, incredibly variable in different regions. There are a number of reasons for that. One has to do with something called glacial rebound. Some areas in some continents that were covered with ice during the last ice age are still, in fact, kind of rebounding, rising in the same way that, like, the couch rises after you take your hand off the couch. It takes a while for the foam to spring back. Continents are sort of like that. So in places like, say, Finland, for example, there's actually the sea levels are falling because the ground is rising so fast as a result of the pulling away of the weight of the ice sheets. But another really important factor is something called gravitational fingerprinting, which sounds very complicated, but really isn't. The two big ice sheets, ice masses on the planet, the one in the north in Greenland and the one in the south in Antarctica, have their own kind of gravitational force, and they, in effect, pull the water towards them. And as these ice sheets begin to melt and they lose mass, they, in fact, that gravitational force declines, and it actually has the effect of pushing water towards the opposite hemisphere. So if you live in New York or Boston and Antarctica melts, as Antarctica melts, you're going to get about 30% more sea level rise than you would if you were in South America. And ditto with the vice versa with Greenland. As Greenland melts, you're going to get about 30% greater sea level rise in South America than you are in, say, Boston or New York. So depending on where you live and what your, you know, where the ice melts first and how quickly that area melts will have a big impact on your local coastal scene.
Right. It gets wild. There was new science in the journal Science Advances in November 2017. And Eric LaRour et al. Say that specific ice masses will affect specific cities. And they say maybe coastal planners should look at where the ice is melting to see what's going to happen to them. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. My name is Alex Smith. Our guest is Jeff Goodall, author of the new book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Jeff, let's talk about some cities facing a slow extinction. Talk to us, what's going on in Miami?
Well, Miami's the sort of poster child for a city at risk with sea level rise. And it's, in fact, my visit there after Hurricane Sandy. I was in New York during Hurricane Sandy and, you know, saw the water that came into New York. And there was about 9 feet of storm surge in lower Manhattan. And a scientist I was talking to said, well, you know, think of this as a sort of dress rehearsal for sea level rise. You know, imagine that 9 feet of water coming in and never going out. And that's what sea level rise will be like. And he said, if you really want to, you know, think about this, go have that same thought exercise down in Miami. And so I did, and I happened to be down there in King Tides, where there are already parts of Miami Beach were getting three feet of seawater into the streets. And it really became clear to me that, you know, in a world of rapidly rising seas, Miami's in big trouble. And it's in big trouble for very simple and obvious reasons. One is you have a whole lot of very expensive real estate right on the beach and right in the lowest areas of the city. And Miami's economy is basically built around real estate. So as that begins to falter, that's a big economic problem for the region. Secondly, it's all very low. Most of Miami-Dade County is less than 6 feet above sea level, so you have basically nowhere high to go to. You know, cities like New York have Washington Heights, places to retreat to that are high ground. You know, obviously, places like Seattle have high ground. Miami, there is no high ground. And the last thing that makes it be in trouble is the fact that it's built on basically Swiss cheese. The limestone that is beneath much of Miami is a particular kind of limestone that has a lot of holes in it. And the water will sort of go right through that. So what that means is you can't really build seawalls in the same way that you can in other areas because the water will just go right underneath the seawalls. So it's basically indefensible, even if you wanted to defend it. And that makes it a city that, you know, really has a kind of ticking clock going behind it.
From your research, Jeff Goodall, would you say more megacities are at risk in the subtropics than in the temperate zones where most of my listeners are now?
No. I mean, I think that, you know, obviously you can tell which cities are at risk simply. The sea level rise is a very simple equation. I mean, it's all about elevation. And so cities that are low and are built on with a lot of fill are the ones that are most at risk. And those, I would guess, tend to be sort of more in the tropics area than in the far north or south. But there's so much fill area in many modern cities. Boston and New York are good examples, but, you know, also a number of European cities. So I think, you know, Jakarta, places like that are hugely at risk because they're subsiding. You have a number of cities in China, including Shanghai, that are hugely at risk. So it's really distributed around the globe.
Are the Chinese making plans to handle sea level rise?
Unfortunately, I was not able to I didn't write a lot about kind of what China is doing on this because, you know, I've been to China a number of times. There was this, so much, you know, I was trying to get a sense of this from a global point of view, and there was only so many places I could go. So I didn't really, you know, look into what's happening in China, but you can see that, you know, China has huge areas at risk in a similar way to the United States and to Europe. I mean, I think China's, to the degree that China has an advantage, they have an advantage in the sense they have a kind of government that can, for better or worse, make kind of authoritative decisions very quickly to move people out of regions, build seawalls and things like that. one of the toughest things for America is that we live in a democracy, and there's many virtues for living in a democracy, but one of them is not fast action on things like this. And so the idea of moving people out of harm's way and even deciding how to spend money for better coastal infrastructure is a very hard-fought and long, slow process.
Did you mention that you'd done some work on rising seas and the impacts on Africa?
Yes, I went to Lagos, to Nigeria, and spent a good deal of time there. And it was very interesting for two reasons. One is that I spent a couple of weeks living in these what are called water slums in Lagos, where about 500,000 people live in essentially what is a lagoon behind the city. And from there, these people live on these, kind of homes that are built on poles out in the water. And, they travel by boat. And after spending a couple of weeks there, it became very clear to me that the problem for sea level rise is that we've built all this infrastructure right on the coast that can't be moved. You talk to these people who live in these Lego slums about sea level rise, and they're like, we don't care. The water goes up 2 or 3 feet. We just build our houses. We just put our houses up a little bit higher. We can do it in a couple of days, and, it's no problem. So that was very instructive to me. The other thing that's happening there is that they're sort of building this sort of what they call the Dubai of Africa, this landfill kind of extension of the coast that is 30 feet high above the seas, defended by, this elaborate structure of riprock and other coastal defense things. It's essentially going to be a kind of fortress from the sea and from other kinds of intrusions in the city of Lagos, which is, I call the chapter Climate Apartheid, because you're really getting a sense of the people who, if you have money and the wherewithal to live in a place like this newly built island, you will be protected and you will be okay. If you are like everybody else, you will not be. You'll be outside the walls and you will be vulnerable. So it was very revealing to me, that trip, in a couple of ways.
Jeff, I wonder how you see the process of a city withdrawing from the sea over time. What happens when their major infrastructure like electric plants, airports, highways, subways, hospitals go under?
That's the $65 billion question. It's hard to know how that will play out. But I think you put your finger on a really important point, which is that a lot of people think, I'll deal with even places like Miami and Florida right now, and Fort Lauderdale right now. You have a lot of people who say, I'll add another foot to my seawall and I'm elevating my house, 4 feet, and I'm going to be okay. And you're not going to be okay, because it's not going to do you any good to have an elevated house if you can't get to your house because the roads are flooded and the economy takes a dive because the airplane is shut down a lot of the time and you have electrical problems and things like that, drinking water problems. So the larger kind of infrastructure around this and the risk to that and how airports will be moved, how cities will begin to, retreat to higher ground and what the economic implications of that are very problematic. And there's certainly going to have to be a lot of relocation, how that will play out, whether it will be, as one person in my book said, a kind of, smart managed retreat, or a kind of Mad Max scenario of just kind of chaos and economic losses and devastation. I don't know, but this being America and how we usually do things, I can kind of guess that the Mad Max scenario is going to win out. But that is the big question about how we will deal with infrastructure.
Well, James Hansen said that rising seas could make some parts of the world ungovernable.
Well, I think that's certainly true. I mean, I think that, as you see parts of, just to take, not to pick on Southern Florida, but it's such an obvious example, as the seas move in there, it's pretty obvious that the conventional kind of governing structures are going to have a hard time keeping up. The parts of the cities will have to be abandoned. What will happen in those abandoned areas, whether, who will move in, what kind of politics that will cause. You're going to have a lot of refugees. And Puerto Rico is just a modest example. You had, obviously, Hurricane Maria came through there and devastated Puerto Rico, and now there's 140,000 or so refugees who have moved to the mainland in Florida. And just that small amount is going to change the sort of politics of that state in a big way. And when you start to think about the kind of dislocation you're going to have as seas rise, I mean, one recent study that I read predicted 2.5 million people displaced in Florida by the end of the century. And that's politically, that's a seismic event. And so how that will play out is anyone's guess.
Yeah, it's going to be huge, just like the immigration into Europe. The millions that went to Europe in 2017 will be nothing compared to that, I guess. And but speaking of worthless real estate, I'm hoping that eventually there will be a giant monolith, big stone pillar erected on Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach as a symbol of dangerous lunacy of climate denial.
I love that idea. That's a fabulous idea.
And you could just keep marking the higher sea levels as they go up, and that's how stupid it was. Say, Jeff Goodall, in 2014, you interviewed Microsoft founder Bill Gates for Rolling Stone magazine. Was he aware of the mega threat of climate change?
Yeah, he certainly is, and he certainly was even at that time. I think that Bill has a he's a technological optimist. You know, and so he believes that, you know, we're going to find kind of clean energy solutions sooner rather than later. He's a big believer in investment, basic research on energy. He himself is funding a lot of research. He's a big believer in sort of new generation nuclear power. And, you know, I think that Bill is, I think he grasps the complexity of all this and the urgency of it. I think he's been pretty outspoken about it. But I do think that he's on the technological optimist side of all this. And he doesn't dwell a lot on the sort of darker side of some of the climate impacts, but more on the urgency of doing something to kind of, you know, displace fossil fuels.
Yeah, it's wild. He is spending a lot of money to help people in the developing world with diseases and basic things like immunization, and good for him. I mean, it's wonderful that he and Melinda have done that. But on the other hand, climate change is going to make those people's lives a living hell anyway. So I want to let that go, though. The Dutch have been leaders in sea level control. Do you think the Netherlands can survive what is coming?
Well, according to people in the Netherlands, you know, they, you know, I spent a lot of time there. And, you know, they've done, obviously, been thinking about living with water for, you know, 1,000 years or more. And their entire kind of governance structure and legal structure of their the Netherlands is built around thinking about water. So they have a lot of not only kind of experience, but kind of capacity for dealing with this in ways that we don't. I mean, we have property rights and things like that are a huge issue that are going to stall a lot of kind of coastal defenses and any kind of changing about how we live on the coast. And they don't have those sorts of problems. But, you know, 30% of the country right now is below sea level. And as the waters rise, they're very well aware of the fact that these dikes and walls and other kind of barrier structures that they've erected to keep their nation dry are not going to work. You can't just keep building higher and higher walls. So they're basically coming up, you know, beginning to think in a different way about it. They have this notion of what they call living with water, encouraging development in ways that encourage floating cities, floating houses, just beginning a kind of transition away from, essentially away from dry land and from thinking that they have to keep their entire nation kind of dry and that they won't be able to. And so how do you live with water in a kind of controlled and peaceable way? And I think that's, they understand, is their future.
Radio EcoShock.
What's the explanation that our weather experts offer as the cause of it all?
I know that London is building new higher tide gates on the Thames, trying to keep back rising seas. But I have talked to people in Britain who realize that the British Houses of Parliament will not be usable in the year 2200. They will be underwater, and they seem rather ready to accept that. I wonder if there is a kind of ready to accept that feeling in many parts of the world now.
No, I don't think that there's a, you know, I think it's one thing to think about being ready to accept something, you know, that's going to be 100 years out, because it's pretty abstract. I'm trying to think if there's anywhere that I've been that, you know, I think for governance and for political bodies, for political leaders, the idea of giving up ground, of giving up not only just, you know, populace and people, but also just actual territory is a very, very difficult concept to embrace. And it will have to be embraced because one scientist said when I was reporting my book, you know, you never want to fight a war with water because water always wins. And water will win in this, the, you know, there'll be no coastal defenses that will really keep it away eventually. And places will lose populace, they will lose tax base, they will shrink, they will go away. But how fast that process happens is what's really up in the air right now. And I don't know any political figure or leader in any nation that is, you know, willing to embrace that, except in some ways the Pacific Islands understand that they have to make a home somewhere else. I mean, they're the closest that I can say to actually embracing this idea that their land, their nation, their home, their identities are going to be subsumed by the water and are beginning to think about what that means and where they will go and how they will live and how they will preserve what they have left.
Some have made an agreement to go to New Zealand, and they've already been over there kind of looking around and laying the groundwork, saying, well, how could we live here?
Yeah, and the people of Kiribati have purchased and been given some number, I think it's 800 acres on Fiji, highland on Fiji, to relocate there. But, you know, this is all good, they having a place to go in that sense. The Marshall Islanders have a thing called the Compact of Free Association with the United States that allows them to come to the United States. One from my book, I went to Springdale, Arkansas, where there's a huge population of Marshall Islanders who work at the chicken plants there, and spent some time with there and talked to them about the losses of their, what it means to lose their nation, you know, as well as going to the Marshall Islands themselves. But, you know, these refuges and places to go are great, but they're not the same thing. I mean, obviously, it's very problematic in very many ways, and I don't know that there's any other solution, but talking to Marshall Islanders now, you feel the grief already, and you feel that sort of sense of loss and the knowing what's going to happen. And I think that kind of psychological mourning is what a lot of people who live on coasts are going to be very soon facing.
It's heartbreaking, and I think there's kind of an international crime involved, but we can't dive into that in this interview. We're starting to wrap up. And as we do, I'm wondering, do you have any ideas on how the public can get involved in starting to prepare and to fight for lower carbon emissions before we go under?
Well, again, that's the big question. I mean, that's been the question for 30 years, you know, and we keep having moments of hope combined and then followed by moments of, you know, regression. So I was in Paris during when the Paris Accord was signed, and all the nations of the world basically signed to that. And it felt to me like a very hopeful and optimistic moment. And I really believed that kind of we had turned the corner and beginning to take this seriously. And then everyone knows what happened. We have the Trump administration, you know, who's done everything they can to undermine this, to undermine the international leadership on this, to claim that this is not real, to erase the climate data, to promote fossil fuels. So it's very hard to see what will drive this. I mean, I think ultimately economics are going to drive this in the sense of cheaper, cleaner energy, declining real estate prices on the coast are going to force people to leave and to sell where they live, to get out of there. But to really solve this and to, you know, to cut carbon emissions to the degree that we need to, it's really a political, and we need, you know, the political leadership that we just simply don't have globally or obviously in the United States. So what people can do, I think, is just get involved politically on every level, making awareness of climate change and cutting carbon emissions the number one issue that they vote on, being outspoken about it, talking to friends about it, and doing everything they can to kind of foment political action on this issue.
Jeff, do you have a website where people can find you, and what is your Twitter feed?
I don't have a website, really. I kind of gave that up a few years ago, but my Twitter feed is just my name, Jeff Goodell, at Jeff Goodell, and people can find me there. I'm on Facebook, you know, and a simple Google search will turn up a lot of my articles and interviews and things like that.
Okay, and I'll put some links to some of your work in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and of course, to your new book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. It's available from all the usual sources. Jeff, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
When you've been through the sort of weather we've all endured these last 7 weeks, there's some gratification in knowing that it's been more than just bad weather.
You have seen graphs of warming as carbon grows in the atmosphere, but new research suggests all carbon is not equal. My weak non-scientific understanding is that maybe each unit of CO2 becomes more damaging to the climate as the decades progress. If true, that could change the whole game, but I need help to understand this. We will explore the new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences on November 28th. The lead author is Paolo Seppi. He's a postdoctoral research assistant with a lot of scientific papers to his credit at the Meteorology Unit, University of Reading, UK. Paolo, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your time. I appreciate it. And I often dig in with the paper abstract. It's a good way for beginners to start. And this one, though, is really dense and it's loaded. So let's try to deconstruct it a bit for the non-scientist. First off, what sort of climate feedbacks become smaller over time as CO2 increases in these climate models?
Yes. So, okay. Feedbacks actually become more positive over time. And what this means is maybe the easiest example is the case of the what we call the ice albedo feedback. So the fact that as the planet warms, sea ice melts, and therefore you're left with a darker sea surface that takes up more solar energy. And that leads to further warming in addition to the warming that was caused by CO2. So that's what we would call a positive feedback. And so what we see, and the subject of our paper, was that our climate models predict that under CO2 forcing, so as you increase CO2 levels, the feedbacks become gradually more positive over time. So they tend to amplify the CO2 forcing even more.
So why does the abstract say they become smaller over time? That's confusing to me.
So let's see. I think it's a bit confusing because there are different time conventions, different things we can look at. And so we said feedbacks become smaller in magnitude. So the total feedback is negative. Sorry, this is a bit technical. The total feedback is negative. That has to be the case for a system that doesn't have a runaway sort of greenhouse gas forcing. And this becomes less negative as time passes. So it becomes more positive, but closer to zero. Does that make some sense?
No, not yet. But are we talking about very long periods of time and eventually the feedbacks wind down? Is that what we're talking about?
So let's see. We're talking about periods of time of the order of decades to centuries. Let's see. So there are various climate feedbacks from different things, like, for example, from sea ice, from changes in cloud cover, changes in atmospheric water vapor, and so on. But the total feedback, so the sum of all these feedbacks, is a negative effect. But this becomes less negative as time passes, or more positive, and closer to zero. So if it can go from, for example, a value of -3 to -2, to give an example.
Okay, well, let's tackle this from another angle. I know that the troposphere is the lowest layer of Earth's atmosphere, and that's where we and the birds live, and up to about the stratosphere. So you have written in that same abstract about tropospheric stability. Now, is that expected to become more stable, or when it changes? This is kind of a complicated question, but when it changes, does it shift to a new stable state or a more chaotic one?
So it's not about chaos, but it's about, maybe a better way to put this is it's about the rates of warming in the at the surface or near the surface and higher up in the atmosphere. So in general, the upper levels of the atmosphere warm faster than the surface for reasons that are pretty well understood that have to do with basic physics. But what we see in the models, what we show in our paper, is that as time passes under CO2 forcing, the upper levels of the atmosphere the warming of the upper levels start to slow down relative to the surface warming. So the difference in warming rate starts decreasing. And this is what we refer to as the stability of the atmosphere. So the response of the atmosphere to CO2 becomes more unstable, so to speak, because the surface warming becomes a bit faster relative to the upper level warming. And this has effects on the amount of cloud cover that you have. So how much cloud cover changes, or how cloud properties change as the planet warms.
Okay, so let's get to really what the purpose of your paper is. And was I correct in my introduction in saying that a unit of carbon emitted later in time may actually have more impact on the Earth than a unit of carbon emitted now?
Yes and no. It's complicated, is the short answer. I would say no based on our paper. Our paper doesn't imply that, actually. Okay, so if you had CO2 increasing at a constant rate, our climate models would say that the warming would speed up. However, that's not because later units of carbon have a more negative or more negative impact or cause more warming, but it's because you have a delayed effect from the older emission of CO2, if that makes sense. So the response to the, if there's a time dependence, that means that later on you'll have more warming than you actually expect from the early response. Does that make some sense?
Yes. Well, I guess some of this boils down to what's called climate sensitivity, and that's
right.
Is based on what happens when the carbon amount doubles. Is that what climate sensitivity is about?
That's correct. So climate sensitivity is just a number that tells you how much surface temperature globally averaged increases for a doubling of atmospheric CO2.
And does that change, that climate sensitivity? Is it changing?
So the problem is we don't know what the climate sensitivity is because we don't have a doubling of CO2 yet. So we have to sort of extrapolate, use current relationships to estimate what it will be in the future at equilibrium. We don't expect to reach equilibrium warming because that takes centuries or millennia. Now, what we see in our climate models is that this estimated climate sensitivity actually goes up as time passes. So first you think the planet will warm only by, say, 3 degrees, but then you realize that the warming starts speeding up, and so then your final estimate of equilibrium warming starts going up. And so basically all our climate models, with very few exceptions, all our complex climate models predict this estimated climate sensitivity value will tend to go up as time passes, assuming CO2 continues increasing.
So my reading of your work, part of what Paolo Seppi does is to look at various climate models that have very different results and try and figure out why those results are different, and maybe even make some suggestions on how they could be harmonized or straightened out. Is that an accurate reading of some of what you do?
In general, yes. In general, there's a lot of differences between our models. So in particular, this climate sensitivity metric that we talked about varies a lot between models. So all our models agree that the planet will warm as CO2 levels increase, but the estimated value of climate sensitivity varies by a factor of more than two between the most sensitive climate model and the least sensitive climate model. So I would say in general, in climate science, and particularly my work also deals with trying to narrow down the range of model outcomes, particularly using observations or using understanding of the physical processes to come up with less uncertain estimates of climate change, sort of more quantitative estimates of how the climate will respond to CO2 forcing.
Well, now here's something I'm worried about, and it's not just me, and that is that climate models may be underestimating what we're really heading into. And there's a brand new paper out by Ken Caldera and Patrick Brown saying exactly that, that measurements of reality show that so far the climate models have been predicting less than what we are experiencing, and that might mean we will have a more extreme future. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I haven't read that paper in detail because it came out only yesterday. My understanding is it's just one line of evidence. So they use some sort of method to weight the models, the climate models, based on how well they represent certain aspects of current climate in order to narrow down the range of uncertainty for future warming predictions. So, and yes, indeed, they say that it seems that the better models actually predict higher warming than we expect currently. It's still very difficult, actually, to narrow the range of predictions I think there's several lines of evidence. So that paper you just mentioned, but also other papers using different methods, either using observational constraints or using a better understanding of the physics. So various papers have been saying that probably the future warming or climate sensitivity will be more towards the upper end of the range of predictions that we have. So as a reminder, the last IPCC report, so the report on by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has a range of climate sensitivity between 1.5 and 4.5. That's the most likely range.
And that's a big range, and it makes a big difference about how fast and how much governments should be doing to save us from climate change.
Yeah, one reason why we care about this climate sensitivity metric is because it's one of the most fundamental ways to measure climate change. It's just a very simple question, right? I mean, you put a certain amount of CO2, how much does the planet warm? And we expect a lot of the impacts of climate change to scale with global warming. So that's why a lot of policy decisions are based on this.
And Paulo, you're also a cloud specialist, are you?
That's right. I mean, yes, I've done work on that.
And there's been a lot of discussion about whether a warmer world will have more or fewer clouds. And if there were more clouds, that might provide a break on warming by deflecting more sunlight, maybe. What are your thoughts on that question?
Yes. So what you're referring to is what we call the cloud feedback. So, for example, how much cloud cover will change with warming, will determine how much warming we get. And actually, maybe the reason why, just to, this is a bit of a digression, but the reason why we care so much about this cloud feedback is because it's actually the main reason why different climate models give different climate sensitivity estimates, is because they disagree on how clouds will respond to warming. Of course, we might hope that clouds respond in a way such as to slow down or reduce the warming, which would be a negative feedback. But actually, the majority of climate models and also the best observational estimates we currently have tend to indicate that cloud feedback will most likely be positive, meaning that clouds will actually amplify global warming. And this is partly due to a predicted decrease in cloud cover in the tropics, which allows more sunlight to reach the surface. But it also has to do with how clouds interact with thermal or infrared radiation that the Earth tries to emit to space to cool itself down. So clouds also act a bit like greenhouse gases by trapping this radiation.
Okay, now I'm going to dive into something that I know nothing about, which is your 2016 paper, Negative Shortwave Feedback. And what is shortwave cloud feedback?
Yeah, so shortwave is our jargon for solar radiation. So a shortwave feedback is a feedback that affects how much solar radiation reaches the surface and can warm the climate. So in that paper, we were talking about a negative cloud feedback on solar radiation that happens in the high latitudes. So specifically, our climate models, at least, well, the vast majority of our climate models predict that in the high latitudes, so say from 50 degrees to the pole or so, clouds will become more reflective of sunlight and therefore will contribute to a local cooling effect with warming.
And then you also write somewhere else that we might expect a decrease in marine tropical low cloud as the planet warms. Why is that?
Yeah, so one thing I should say first maybe is despite what I said about the high latitude negative cloud feedback, globally we expect cloud feedback to be positive, so that the globally averaged effect will be a warming effect, so to speak. And this is in large part because of what you just referred to, this low tropical low cloud decrease, which is expected to happen because the tropics take up a large part of the Earth's surface. And so the exact reasons for that positive tropical cloud feedback are still a matter of debate. It's very difficult to represent these clouds in climate models. And so actually, climate models disagree to a large extent on this specific aspect of the climate change response of clouds. But we're starting to have fairly good observational evidence thanks to satellite records that are becoming long enough. So we have reliable satellite records since roughly year 2000. And these records give us a global, you know, coverage of clouds and their effects on radiation. And they do show that when surface temperatures go up, the amount of cloud, and particularly low clouds, tends to decrease, and therefore allowing more solar radiation to reach the surface.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to the Radio EcoShock show. My guest from the University of Reading in the UK is Dr. Paolo Seppi. We're talking about clouds and more warming and climate, all stimulated by a new paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And Paolo, a few years ago, I talked several times with cloud expert Timothy Garrett at the University of Utah, and he told me that cloud science was one of the last unexplored frontiers in science. Because of the chaos and the difficulty of the study, it leaves a lot of questions, he said. What do you think?
Yes, I would agree with that. So I guess clouds are maybe the biggest challenge for our climate models. The problem is that climate models, you know, they do a fairly good job at representing current climate and its response to increasing greenhouse gases, but they really struggle with processes that happen on very small spatial scales. And clouds are very complex. They have, I mean, if you look at them, you know, if you look at the sky, clouds are very complex shapes. They come in all sorts of types at different heights, and they can be thick or they can be thin. And models really struggle realistically representing these clouds and the effect they have on radiation, which is what controls global warming, really. So as I was saying earlier, clouds are the main reason why climate models disagree on how much the planet will warm. This has been a problem for decades, and we're still working on improving the physical representation of the processes that are responsible for clouds.
I'd like to blunder into another topic that you've discussed, namely the baroclinicity of the atmosphere. Now, according to Wikipedia, a baroclinic atmosphere is one for which the density depends on both the temperature and the pressure. Contrast this with barotropic atmosphere, for which the density depends only on the pressure. So all I know about pressure and the atmosphere is probably comes from TV weathermen. So what is baroclinicity in the atmosphere, and does it matter?
Yeah, so this was in a different context. We were talking about atmospheric circulation. So baroclinicity is a property of the atmosphere that affects the circulation of the atmosphere. It's jargon, but what it refers to is basically, to put it the most simple way possible, is the temperature gradient between low and high latitudes, and that determines how strong the winds are in the middle latitudes and also how strong the storms are. And so in the context of climate change, one thing we care about is how this baroclinicity, or how the temperature gradients between low and high latitudes, will evolve as the planet warms, because that will determine how our storms change and how the jet stream position and variability will change, and this ultimately will affect our weather.
Okay, now, you've raised another question in my mind, and that is, scientist James Hansen warned that a more rapid ice melt on Greenland could weaken or deflect the Great Atlantic Current that warms Europe. I'm wondering, does something similar happen in the atmosphere? Are atmospheric currents already changing?
It's hard to say, mainly because the atmosphere is naturally very variable. So even if we already have a forcing, because greenhouse gases are increasing, but the signal due to the forcing is still relatively small compared with the amount of daily or monthly variability that naturally occurs. That being said, I think we already have some evidence that the currents in the atmosphere, or the circulation of the atmosphere, is changing or has changed. Maybe the best example for that is the effect of the ozone hole. So you may have heard of the Antarctic ozone hole, the fact that we have lost the ozone cover that we have in the lower stratosphere, so around 20 kilometers or so over the South Pole. This, in turn, is because of certain gases that have been emitted by industrial processes during the 20th century. And so this ozone hole has caused changes in temperature over the polar cap over Antarctica, which in turn have had an effect on the southern hemispheric circulation. And that's something that we have both observational evidence for and also evidence from climate models. So we have several lines of evidence that show that human activities have already started changing the circulation of the atmosphere. And we expect that greenhouse gases will have similar effects on the atmospheric circulation, at least based on what models are telling us. But we don't yet have quite enough observational data to tell whether that's happening.
Yes, and you did some research on the Southern Hemisphere. I like that because we don't hear enough about it. And again, another question, we've heard about the winds tightening around Antarctica, which has changed the weather in Australia. And I might have expected the same thing to happen at the North Pole, but so far it seems to me that the jet stream has actually weakened with loops penetrating further south into the U.S. than expected instead of retreating towards the pole. What is going on?
Yeah, so the northern and southern hemispheres respond somewhat differently or change quite differently as the planet warms. And this is related to this baryclinicity we talked about earlier. So, for example, in the northern hemisphere, you have a lot of warming over the Arctic region because you lose sea ice there. So you have a lot of, you know, warming at high latitudes, and that changes the temperature gradient between the high latitudes and the lower latitudes. And that, in turn may have an effect on mid-latitude winds and circulation. Whereas in the southern hemisphere, you actually, the north to south gradients, temperature gradients change in quite different ways. And you have less warming at high latitudes because Antarctica is just staying where it is. You will still have a nice sheet there for quite a while. So that's also why we expect the atmospheric circulation to change in pretty different ways in the southern hemisphere compared with the northern hemisphere. Now, what you refer to with the sort of waviness of the jet stream and the cold and hot spells that we may have in middle latitude regions and the link to temperature gradients, that's still pretty debated in the community. So there really isn't enough observational evidence, I would say, to tell whether there is an impact from global warming on the circulation in the northern hemisphere.
You were the lead author of a paper titled Fast and Slow Components of Extratropical Atmospheric Circulation Response to CO2 Forcing. Can you give us a brief glimpse into what those fast and slow responses are?
Sure, I can try. So essentially, we were looking at how the climate system responds to CO2 increases at various timescales. And this is easiest to understand in somewhat idealized, somewhat simplified experiments where you increase CO2 all at once, and then you allow the climate system to respond to this forcing. And what we see is that there are various timescales. We highlighted two timescales that we call fast and slow. So the fast being on the order of one decade, slow being on the order of one century or several centuries. And so these two timescales of climate change have very different properties, or the climate changes in very different ways, especially atmospheric circulation, which is what we were looking at in that paper. And so we showed that most of the atmospheric circulation changes that are relevant to the middle to high latitudes, so regions like where you live in Vancouver, for example, those changes happen on the fast timescale, so they happen within a few years of the increase in CO2. And so that's something that is useful to know if we're interested in the long-term impacts of increasing greenhouse gases, because it tells us that at least for mid-latitude circulation, most of these impacts might happen quite soon after the CO2 increase.
Let's return to your newest paper. And a press summary says the influence of increasing levels of atmospheric CO2 on global warming will become more severe over time. Now, that's probably the take-home and a very important point. Would you talk to us about that?
Yes. So in this paper, we were trying to explain why. So if our climate models say that if greenhouse gases increase at a constant rate, temperature will or global warming will start speeding up. So this has to do with how climate feedbacks, so for example, how clouds change as the planet warms. And our climate models are saying that, for example, the cloud feedback will become more and more positive as warming proceeds. So that's what was the subject of this paper. We were trying to provide a mechanism for why this change in the climate feedbacks happens in our climate models.
Well, I can see how your conclusions are important to help climate modelers, and you have a history of analyzing and testing models, as I said, but it also sounds to me like a very dangerous finding for all of us trapped here in a warming reality. What do you think?
Yes, so I think there are several implications. One important implication from this study, I think, is it tells us something about what we can learn from recent climate change in order to infer things about future long-term climate change. So what our paper shows, for example, is that because climate feedbacks increase over time, if we use present-day or recent climate change observations to infer long-term warming, we may actually underestimate the long-term warming because we are using information based on the present-day feedbacks, which are less warming than the future feedbacks. And so this understanding actually helps us to reconcile observational estimates of future warming with what the climate models are telling us, because we're looking actually at different timescales in the observations versus the climate models.
And that stimulates another idea in me, and that is that the general scenario proposed by governments is that carbon emissions will peak at some point and then gradually reduce as we convert away from fossil fuels. I find that idea dangerous on the face of it, but even if we accept that, it sounds like the tail of emissions while we decarbonize could be more dangerous than we thought. Is that a reasonable reading from your paper?
Not directly from our paper, actually. So our paper doesn't imply that a future unit of CO2 will itself cause more warming, although there are other lines of evidence, not from our paper, that do suggest that at higher levels of CO2, every unit of CO2 will become a bit more harmful, if you like, or will cause more warming. But that's slightly different from what we talk about in our paper. What our paper actually says is one unit of CO2 emission now, its effect will actually be amplified later on because of timescales that are intrinsic to the climate system, delayed responses, if you like. And so this has to do with these feedbacks becoming more positive later on. So if I put an extra unit of CO2 now, you will have, for example, a change in cloud cover to the warming caused by the CO2. But then later on in time, clouds will start responding in a different way, which will start amplifying this warming.
You know, I finally understood your paper.
I'm glad.
From the UK, we've been talking with Dr. Paolo Seppi, a postdoctoral research assistant and prodigious scientific digger at the Meteorology Unit, University of Reading. You can find links to Paolo's webpage and the science we've talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. The paper's title is Relationship of Tropospheric Stability to Climate Sensitivity and Earth's Observed Radiation Budget. Paolo, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks to you. It was my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.
Ripping apart the social fabric of how society works.
And it's influencing the next generation.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. In November, Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri attempted to deliver his resignation, with many analysts suggesting the entire theater was engineered by Saudi Arabia. As the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima wrote in mid-November, quote, the latest Saudi power play to weaken the Lebanese resistance and political movement Hezbollah by forcing Lebanon's Prime Minister Saad Hariri to resign appears to have backfired. After a bizarre episode in which he appeared to be held captive by the Saudis before traveling to Paris and then Cairo, Hariri finally returned to Beirut in mid-November. There he promptly rescinded his resignation after meeting with Lebanese President Michel Aoun. This comes on the heels of Saudi's moves to publicly embrace Israel after years of allying in the shadows. And as Israel continues to threaten Lebanon, its civilians, and Hezbollah with yet another war, 11 years after the Israeli military's defeat there in 2006. We're excited to be joined today by Assad Abu Khalil, professor at California State University Stanislaus, and the author of the widely read blog, The Angry Arab News Service. We wanted to bring him on today to talk about the current political situation in Lebanon and how Saudi Arabia and Israel fit into the equation. Assad, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for hosting me.
So let's get into the weeds here. Can you talk about the chronology of events over the last month or so? How do you analyze the Hariri resignation attempt here?
Well, I think I would certainly place it in the context you alluded to, which is a growing Israeli-Saudi alliance, not only over Lebanon, but throughout the Middle East. And it is partly that, and it is partly the fact that the new ruler of Saudi Arabia since 2015, the Crown Prince, is really not finding his way around the world. He is engaged in many adventures, he's overstretched, and every adventure he launches, it doesn't go the way he intends to. Things are not going his way in Palestine, where he wanted to push a certain faction over others. He was a big advocate, like UAE, of Mohammed Dahlan. They wanted to bring him in back to Palestine, and that hasn't worked yet. In Lebanon, he has exactly the same agenda as Israel, which is to basically disarm the resistance. It's not about Hezbollah. It's not about Hezbollah's ideology. It's about making Lebanon safe for Israeli aggression and invasion. And that's what this is about. In Yemen, things are going really badly, and he wanted to have a scapegoat. And he convince himself rather bizarrely that the reason why they are not doing well in Yemen, his armies and the UAE, is because of Hezbollah's intervention. In reality, and WikiLeaks confirmed that, the relations between the Houthis, who now control Yemen, and the Iranians were never very strong. I mean, if anything, the launching of the Saudi attack on Yemen inaugurated the relations between the Houthis and the Iranians, and certainly made them closer. Hezbollah's role is really tangential, purely in terms of media campaign and support and speeches in that regard. And also, they do not need Hezbollah support. So he decided that Hezbollah was in charge, and especially after the missiles landing on Riyadh. Saad al-Hariri is not the only prime minister who is a mere puppet of the Saudi government. What is interesting about media coverage of Lebanon is that we have heard for many years about senior regime controlling this prime minister or that prime minister, but we rarely hear about Saudi regime controls of this ruler and that prime minister or that president or that speaker throughout the Arab world. They control them by a variety of means, either through bribery or blackmail or both. Saad al-Hariri was handpicked by the King of Saudi Arabia to succeed his father after his assassination in 2005. They decided that he went too far in the national unity government that was formed this year. They basically wanted Lebanon to be in a state of constant instability as long as would that paralyze Hezbollah and weaken it. And they basically assumed so naively and foolishly that they weren't going to get rid of Saad al-Hariri and replace him with his brother. The plan did not go as well as they intended because there was so much humiliation that most Lebanese felt the choreography of the resignation. The fact he was summoned there and he was put under house arrest, even though nobody in the Arab world is supposed to admit that he was in fact a prisoner, just like the other princes who were prisoners in the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. And he was made to read a statement that they wrote for him. It's obviously a lie when he claimed later that he wrote his own statement. Saad al-Hariri is not somebody who can write one full sentence of Arabic on his own. So he read that statement, and that was supposed to change the political map of Lebanon. Instead, the man who has very little limited abilities and capabilities suddenly became a national hero, and there was a rallying cry behind him, and people were pleading the world for his return. And the president of Lebanon stood very resolved against Saudi attempt to change the political landscape of Lebanon, and he basically directed his efforts to France and other Western governments, calling for the release of the prime minister. And he said bluntly in one particular point that the prime minister is detained and that Saudi Arabia committed an act of aggression against Lebanon. He used these words. And even though the media in the West did not report those. And then, of course, he was released. He came back to Lebanon to a welcome zero. And Saudi Arabia is now not at square one, but it is worse than what it was before it started the crisis. But this crisis really tells us about the political and military skills of the new upstart crown prince of Saudi Arabia.
That's the voice of Assad Abu Khalil. Assad, let's talk specifically about the shadows here. For many years, Saudi and Israel have been aligned, but not publicly, and now they're coming out of the shadows. How and why is this happening right now?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that the Saudi-Israel alliance goes back all the way to the 1950s. In every conflict in the Middle East since the 1950s, we can safely say in civil wars, in regional conflict, that Saudi Arabia and Israel were on the same side. In 1958, there was a civil war in Lebanon. United States, Saudi Arabia, and Israel were on the same side. In the Lebanese civil war, right at the outset of the war, Saudi Arabia and Israel were on the same side. Both of them were supplying the right-wing militia death squads, clients of Israel, with arms and money. If you talk about the Yemeni war of the 1960s, for much of that period, there is enough evidence now, which I shared with readers in Arabic, to point out that the cooperation between the Israelis and the Saudis in that war, and how meetings took place first in India which later blossomed into closer coordination between the two governments. But something else has changed. Since September 11, the United States, the Saudi Arabia government was aware of growing resentment against its role in financing international fanatical groups all around the world. And they wanted to win back the support of Congress. And they did that by following a recipe that most Arab governments and even the PLO and the Yasser Arafat followed, which is to appease the Israeli lobby. And that's exactly what the Saudis have done. Since then, under Ambassador Bandar bin Sultan, who was ambassador here in America during that time, they started open relationship with the Israeli lobby, and they coordinated closely together. And it was only then that previous previous Israeli lobby objections to American arms deal to Saudi Arabia were lifted completely. And now we find that no matter how many arms deals are reached between Saudi Arabia and Israel and the United States, there are never any objections by the Israeli lobby, which is something rather new. So I would say that there are several factors that created this climate of coordination. They see eye to eye on the Palestinian question. As a former advisor to Netanyahu said, the Israelis really don't, the Saudis don't give a deal about what happens to the Palestinians. They also see eye to eye on trying to challenge the Iranian role in the region, in the whole region. And the Saudis were in favor of an Israeli attack on Iran throughout the years, and in fact, tried to lobby the American government in that direction. They also see an eye to eye on how to deal with the Arab uprising since 2011. As we remember from New York Times reporting, both both Saudi King and Netanyahu were lobbying the Obama administration to keep Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian dictator, in power. So they wanted to keep the regional order under an authoritarian control of the Saudi regime. And now they also coordinate together as two allies who have been unhappy with some aspect of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, especially during the Obama administration. So the joint dissatisfaction by the Saudi government and the Israeli government brought them closer together in that they felt Obama was not heeding their advice and was not taking seriously the threat from Iran that they saw.
And how does that differ from how the Trump administration has picked up this foreign policy and its alliance with Saudi?
Well, they have been thrilled. The Saudis and the Israelis have been really thrilled with the Trump administration for good measure. Don't get me wrong. It's not that Obama administration was in any way less pro-Israeli or pro-Saudi than this administration. But this administration is unconditional in its support for both Israel and the Saudi government. And they also gives them more leeway for action. You see, the Obama administration, if at some points tried to restrain the Israeli behavior or Saudi behavior, it only did that in order to protect those governments. You see, they did that because they thought their calculations were not in their own best interest. So Israel, the United States was acting for the best interest of Israel or the Saudi government. This administration does not really care. So even if the Saudi ruler is screwing up and making all sorts of blunder, and even if he may be undermining his own regime, hopefully that occurs, they just don't care. They just want to give a short-term support for whatever the Saudi ruler or the Israeli leader want to do, even if it's not in their own interest. And that's why they're very happy. So they feel there are no restraints. There are no traditional restraints from the United States on their own behavior in the region. And that is new. What is also to their liking is that for the first time they see that the United States does not have a specific regional agenda, which means they can really do whatever they want in the region, and that's what's been happening. And that's why they are closer together than ever, because now they feel we can chart the course of events in this region since the United States is not there to bother us.
That's right. Let's bring it back to Lebanon in terms of Israel's continuing to threaten Lebanese civilians and Hezbollah with yet another war. Hezbollah seems to be even more powerful and organized than it was a decade ago. What would happen if Israel attempted to wage another war on Lebanon right now?
Well, I am of the view that the war is unlikely because Israel is very afraid of another confrontation with an army of volunteers which humiliated the mighty Israeli army in the last confrontation. What happened in 2006 is historic in the context of Arab-Israeli wars. For the first time, we've seen the entire psychological advantage of the Israeli army, the fact that it's invincible and that Arabs are supposed to be scared of the Israeli might have gone. We now see the Arabs are fully aware it is now reversed, that the Israeli army is now scared of an army of young volunteers who forced the hand of the Israeli army in 2006 and made them humiliatingly withdraw from Lebanon in 2000 and later in 2006 when they failed to penetrate any kilometers inside Lebanese territory. For these reasons, the Israeli government is satisfied with the production of bluster and bombast. They just issue threat that, of course, Western correspondents in the Middle East never bother to cover. Almost every day, certainly every week, there is some Israeli official who threatens Lebanon, not Lebanon, the civilians of Lebanon, with death and destruction in the next confrontation. Hezbollah has been acting rather cautiously in that regard, but they also promise that if they are attacked by the Israelis, they will teach them a lesson, just like the lesson they taught them last time around.
Finally, Assad, you monitor the Arab news media very closely. What are you watching most carefully right now in the region, especially with regards to Israel and the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I think that the thing that one watches with great alarm is this triangle of power between Jared Kushner, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and Netanyahu. This triumvirate of three powers that have absolutely no regard for the lives and welfare of people in the region, raises alarm about the near future, what's going to happen. And I think it's a recipe, those three, that we are going to see yet another attempt by this group of three governments to end once and for all the Palestinian cause. But of course, it's not going to succeed. There were so many prior attempts to do that in so many decades. We are now marking the one century anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, and the Palestinian cause remains alive today as it was a century ago. Yet, for the first time now, even Sadat did not go as far. We have now the Saudi government willing to basically give Israel the gift of normalization without having Israel submit or present the Palestinians with any acceptable compromise whatsoever. So instead of land for peace, which used to be the formula for the Saudis, we're going to have peace for nothing. The Saudis are going to provide Israel with full normalization in return for vague promises of economic self-development for the Palestinians, which is exactly the formula that is being prepared by Jared Kushner in close coordination with the Israeli Prime Minister. I am also watching very closely, obviously, the development inside Saudi Arabia. I am really banking on the new Crown Prince that he may be our best hope to end once and for all the rule of the House of Saud. If he keep acting the way he is, we may witness that in our lifetime.
That would be remarkable, to say the least.
I can't wait.
I can't wait for one of your books to come out on whatever happens.
Okay.
Assad Abu Khalil, you're a professor at Cal State University at Stanislaus and the author of the blog, The Angry Arab News Service, which can be found at angryarab.blogspot.com. Thanks again for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you very much, Nora. Take care.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Alan Essig, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the GOP's very unpopular tax legislation's long-term impact on working families and rising economic inequality in the U.S. Victor Picard, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, who examines how the FCC's repeal of net neutrality rules endangers internet freedom and the fight ahead to restore net neutrality protections. And Beatrice Codiani of the group Sex Workers and Allies Network and Brett Davidson of the Connecticut Bail Fund, who spoke at the recent International Data and Violence Against Sex Workers rally in New Haven, Connecticut. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Human rights activists are putting pressure on Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to cancel a $12 billion arms sale to Saudi Arabia, equipping vehicles with machine guns and anti-tank cannons. Trudeau explained that his government is only honoring the arms deal, which was negotiated by his predecessor, former Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Human rights monitors told Al Jazeera Canadian weapons have been used in atrocities committed by the Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen, as well as against dissidents in the kingdom's eastern Katif region. Amnesty International opposes all arms sales to Saudi Arabia due to persistent human rights violations in Yemen. Canada is the second largest arms supplier to Saudi Arabia, behind the United States. Saudi Arabia's powerful crown prince, 32-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, has pursued the war against Houthi rebels in Yemen and is countering Iranian influence elsewhere. In Canada, constitutional law professor Daniel Terp filed a lawsuit to stop the Saudi arms sale. The suit claims the arms deal violates Canadian export law and the Geneva Conventions. At the One Planet Summit, hosted by French President Emmanuel Macron, the World Bank pledged to stop making loans supporting oil and gas exploration in developing nations beginning in 2019. The new policy is part of a broader World Bank commitment to implement the Paris Climate Accord. The global financial institution will also report on greenhouse gas emissions produced by energy projects it finances. At the same time, the World Bank announced a $1 trillion investment in developing clean energy sources, including renewables, efficiency, and public transit, to meet commitments made in the Paris Climate Accord. $650 million to build 13 solar energy plants in Egypt are among the projects which will be funded. The Bank of England's governor announced that there is growing support for transparency among big banks and corporations, revealing their exposure to climate change risks in order to promote the development of a low-carbon economy. The initiative is supported by major UK banks, including Lloyds, Barclays, and the Royal Bank of Scotland. Across California, 30% of tenants pay half their income in rent and utilities, triple the costs during the boom times of the 1960s. Over the last decade, construction of affordable housing in California has trailed far behind job and population growth. As a result, the United Way of Greater Los Angeles expects a dramatic rise in the region's homeless population. Rent increases in places like San Francisco and Boston have led to new demands for rent control and tenants' rights. Housing activists in San Jose have waged a hunger strike that successfully pressured the city to adopt the nation's toughest rent regulations. New York recently became the first major city to pay for lawyers to assist tenants fighting evictions. Over the last few years, housing activism has expanded across the country, a trend that transcends the issue of rent control through its focus on halting gentrification and protecting low-income people of color from displacement. Isaac Simon Hodes of the group United for Change in Lynn, Massachusetts, told In These Times magazine that all these battles are part of the broader struggle to defend the human right to housing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
With House and Senate passage of a final version of the Republican tax reform bill almost a certainty, Donald Trump and GOP legislators are about to get their first major legislative win since the 2016 election. But in the long run, that partisan victory will be felt as a net loss for millions of Americans. The tax reform bill will permanently lower the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%. Businesses will be taxed at a lower rate than the majority of Americans who are wage earners. For individuals, the top income tax rate will be reduced to 37% from its current level of 39.6%. The super wealthy will also see benefits from reductions in the alternative minimum tax and the estate tax. Analysis by the Tax Policy Center finds that in 2018, working families will see some modest reductions in their taxes. But overall, the benefits of the new tax law will be concentrated among the wealthiest sector, with nearly two-thirds of the benefits going to the richest one-fifth of Americans. Because the individual tax cuts are temporary, by the year 2027, 53% of all Americans will pay more in taxes under the GOP tax bill. That year, 82.8% of the bill's benefits will go to the top 1%. Many observers believe the tax bill, which will add $1.46 trillion to the national debt over the next decade, will be used by the GOP to justify major cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, the Republican tax bill's inclusion of a provision to eliminate the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate will result in 13 million Americans losing their health insurance coverage and higher premiums overall. Your reporter spoke with Alan Essig, executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, who assesses the GOP's very unpopular tax plan's long-term impact on working families and rising economic inequality in the U.S.
It's basically a Christmas gift to the most profitable corporations and the wealthiest Americans. It is a bill that has been written for and geared towards and most benefit towards that group. There are individual tax cuts included in this also. The individual tax cuts as a share are much smaller than the tax cuts that go to businesses and to the wealthy. The individual tax cuts actually are temporary. They phase out and go away in 2025, while the corporate tax cuts are permanent. As unfair as the bill is when it's first implemented in 2018, 2019, it gets worse over time. It cuts the corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. It cuts the top income tax rate from a little over 39% to 37%. By 2027, 10 years from now, it actually raises taxes on the bottom 60% of taxpayers. You know, it does not simplify the tax code at all. It actually makes it much more complicated. It is a accountant and lawyer bill. If there's one sector of the economy that's going to do really well, it's going to be tax lawyers and accountants to try to figure out what this does and to take advantage of all the, you know, not only the existing loopholes that they kept, but the new loopholes that they brought in. Again, as a whole, it is something that does not necessarily benefit the middle class. You know, if you look at the middle 20%, which we consider actually the middle class, in 2019, they will get on average about an $800 tax cut, while the richest 1% will get a tax cut of over $55,000. And it's not just, you know, some folks say that, well, you know, the wealthy pay more, so of course they will have more dollar amount. But it's not just the increased dollar amount they're getting; it's as a share of their income, they're getting a bigger break than anybody else.
Tell us how this tax bill
will affect already record income inequality in the United States as compared to the rest of the industrialized world?
Oh, it'll just make it worse. The overwhelming benefits of this are to the top 1%, the top 5%. You know, right now, the income inequality has gotten considerably worse over the last 40 years. This is something that will make it even more unequal. There'll be more money flowing to the top, less money floating below. The estimated wage increases that the administration talks about is a fantasy. Anyone who's looked at it, any economist, any other group, the benefits clearly flow to the top, which, again, will just make a bad inequality situation even worse.
If, as expected, this tax bill passes and it's signed into law by President Trump, how can the Democrats, if they retake control of Congress and the White House over the next 4 years, repeal the Trump GOP tax cuts? Is it pretty easy to undo these tax cuts and to revisit changes in the tax code that would truly benefit people in the middle and among working families, something that this current legislation really does not do?
For the Democrats to do it, they would need to control both houses of Congress and the White House, because obviously any one Republican control can veto it, can stand in the way of doing rational tax policy. I mean, the ideal thing would be if the Democrats were in control is to truly do a bipartisan fix to this, to truly simplify our tax code, to get rid of the corporate loopholes that are in and that this bill makes even worse, to really gear the tax code to the benefit of low, moderate, middle-income folks. You know, it may be my Mr. Smith goes to Washington view of things, but I do think that it's possible. But it would take a truly bipartisan effort to do that, to really put the focus on the middle class, on low, moderate-income folks. But, you know, it needs to be done for the right reasons, for the right economic reasons, for the right tax policy reasons, and not just for pure political reasons to pay off those donors who donate money to the political class. I think that's possible to do, but is it easy? No. But I think it's a worthy goal to have.
That was Alan Essig, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Learn more about the GOP tax bill's impact on rising economic inequality in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As expected, the Federal Communications Commission voted along party lines on December 14th to repeal the nation's net neutrality rules. Those rules, since their ratification in 2015, had prevented internet service providers like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon from engaging in censorship or controlling what consumers see and do on the web by slowing down or denying access to specific websites, apps, and other online services. The absence of regulation under net neutrality will now allow broadband providers to charge customers for paid prioritization, which could transform the internet into something that looks more like cable television, where consumers would be charged additional fees to gain access to certain websites at faster speeds. Before the FCC voted to eliminate net neutrality, nationwide protests were organized on December 7th. Now, after the vote, public interest groups and state attorneys generals are preparing lawsuits pushing for the restoration of net neutrality rules. And a campaign is gearing up to pressure Congress to overturn the FCC vote by passing a resolution of disapproval that would undo the FCC's dismantling of net neutrality rules. Your reporter spoke with Victor Picard, Associate Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Here, Picard examines how the repeal of net neutrality rules endangers internet freedom and the difficult fight ahead to restore net neutrality protections.
Well, I think it's going to affect us quite dramatically. At least, it may seem subtle at first, but what the FCC essentially did was entirely throw out the net neutrality protections that were put in place in 2015. But these protections prevented our internet service providers like Verizon and Comcast from interfering with our online content, from slowing it down, blocking it, or setting up fast and slow lanes where they prioritize certain kinds of content over others and force content creators to pay up. This is radically changing the underlying logic of the internet. And without sounding too melodramatic, it really is a blow to democracy. It's going to affect us in economic ways. It'll affect us as consumers of the internet. But I think most important, it's really going to affect the way that we can express ourselves creatively and politically online. So I don't think we can really exaggerate how profound of a change that will be if this goes through, and it, at least initially it will go through in January.
So, Victor, who are the big beneficiaries of this repeal of net neutrality? Who are the ones making the phone calls and visiting the offices of FCC commissioners and taking FCC Chair Ajit Pai out to lunch to push for these changes?
Yes. Part of the question we can only speculate, although I'm sure some of it is in the public record. But certainly, by all appearances, Ajit Pai is doing the work of these telecommunication companies. And really, I think no matter how you look at this, the only beneficiaries of losing net neutrality are those internet service monopolies like Verizon and Comcast. And of course, Ajit Pai used to work for Verizon. Some people suggest he thinks that he still does, even as FCC chair. But one way of describing this, it sounds like a very academic concept, but it's pretty straightforward, which is this idea of regulatory capture. And that's when you have a regulatory agency like the FCC that begins to harmonize its actions. Essentially, it internalizes the logics and the value systems of the industries that it purportedly regulates. And I think what we see with the FCC today is a textbook case of regulatory capture, not just with net neutrality, but almost every decision they've made in the last 10 months has been a longstanding wish for either telecommunication companies or broadcast companies. So it really does seem like the FCC is just doing customer service for these industries.
Just a question about Congress. You can give us your own view on where lawsuits might take this fight. But maybe a more realistic approach is trying to get Congress to overturn this repeal, given that there is bipartisan support for net neutrality. Do you have any feelings about where this may go? Is the House and Senate leadership diametrically opposed to net neutrality? Is there some opening there, you think, where enough public pressure could create results?
I think there is an opening, and I do think that's probably the most immediate thing that we as engaged citizens can really get involved, is to try to call our members of Congress, because you know it might be a pretty big hill to climb to get enough votes to pass this Congressional Review Act, but it's certainly worth a shot. And I think it goes without saying that the more pressure that we apply now, the more momentum we get on this, it's only going to help in the long run. I think it's also putting members of Congress on notice that voters are going to remember this in a short, 11 or so months away in the midterm elections. People are going to be voting on these kinds of issues. And you even saw some Republican members towards the end getting close to the FCC decision who wrote letters, signed letters, saying that the FCC should delay the vote or even decide to keep net neutrality. So we started to see a bit of, some sway on this. And I do think if the public maintains pressure, we could see real dividends here. Even, again, if we don't ultimately succeed, this is going to be a long-term struggle. And I actually would say with the courts, I would say I've heard very smart people who know our legal system and the law much better than I do, who say that we have at least 50-50 odds in the courts. So, I think we have a good shot with the courts as well. Yeah, I'm always pleasantly surprised that even though, again, it sounds so wonky when you say net neutrality, but people get it within seconds of the conversation. I mean, I think, probably a better way of framing it and describing it is calling it about, this is all about the open internet. But this ongoing fight about net neutrality is as important as it is and will remain so for the foreseeable future. I think it also underscores the need for creating truly public alternatives this idea that, you know, we just can't rely on these commercial providers and that we should be taking at least sectors of the internet out of the market. We should try to create these public structural alternatives like community or municipal owned and operated broadband networks. So we're not constantly fighting with these internet monopolies. And I think that's something that's an exciting area that I'm actually optimistic about, although that's also going to be a huge fight in the coming years.
That was Victor Picard, Associate Professor of Communication at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy. Connect with national groups fighting to restore net neutrality by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers was observed this year on December 17th in cities here in the U.S. and around the world. A group in New Haven, Connecticut, calling themselves Sex Workers and Allies Network, or SWAN, held a rally in March in solidarity with sex workers and to mourn the many women and some men who have died or been murdered on the street. Those attending the rally also remembered two local women who disappeared and are now presumed dead. Beatrice Codiani co-founded SWAN and spends time almost every day walking New Haven streets to offer help and comfort to sex workers. SWAN members engage in daily outreach and harm reduction in the city, handing out winter clothes, clean needles, condoms, and naloxone, a medication that treats opioid overdoses. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers rally in New Haven and recorded the speakers who addressed the gathering. We first hear from Beatrice Codiani, co-founder of SWAN, followed by Brett Davidson of the Connecticut Bail Fund.
At the end of October of last year, I happened to pick up my phone and on one of the news apps, I saw the faces of 14 women, and it says 14 women arrested in a prostitution sting, and it just really made me go back crazy because years ago, I was strung out on heroin, and I was out there on the street. And I know this, and I was in the closet about that for 50 years because I was so ashamed and so stigmatized. And here they were doing it to these women. But what really, really made me go batshit crazy was it said that this sting was a massive undercover operation. So I got in touch with the chief of police, and who claimed he didn't know anything about it. It was done under him, and he doesn't hear about these things. And, you know, so I told him a massive undercover operation. I mean, all that money, all those resources could have been gone to helping the women on the street instead of, you know, arresting them and stigmatizing not only them but their children. So he agreed to meet with Brett and I. The end result was that the chief of police called the stings off, which was really amazing because usually they don't do that. So then after that, Brett and I and other activists in the community got together and said, well, what are we going to do? I mean, we have to do more. So we, not knowing what we were doing, got little goodie bags of things that people in this organization donated, with hats, gloves, scarves, hand warmers, a little personal item, you know, coffee cards to Dunkin' Donuts so that people can get off the street for a minute and keep warm. And we just walked down the street and we saw women and we told them about the rally we had. We invited them to it, but they didn't come. But then we just kept coming back and talking to the woman. If you know somebody who's a sex worker, you know, please give them, you know, we had a card, and we had information about it. And gradually, the woman started talking to us and pouring their hearts out. And we asked first, you know, what do you need? And every one of them said housing. And we couldn't supply that because, you know, we were broke. But we try to, you know, we pass out condoms. We do needle exchange. We're a part now of the Greater Hartford Coalition for Harm Reduction. And they supply us with Narcan kits. And they came in handy for one of our members who overdosed. But the person she was with knew that she had a Narcan kit, and he saved her life. We're building up a reputation on the street of being a very useful organization among our members. So we also, I'm very proud to say that SWOM was invited to George Soros Open Society Foundation for a Sex Worker Summit. What we'd like is for the city to do something. We are just a grassroots organization making huge changes, building a coalition, getting trust and respect in this. This could have been done years ago, and it hasn't. So I don't want to talk too much. I know it's cold, and so I'm going to turn it over to Brett. Do you want to say about the bail fund?
Yeah, it's not easy work coming out here every day because there's constant crises. People are out here dying, undergoing a lot of violence, all kinds of political violence, violence from people on the street. And Beatrice, often by herself, is there as the only witness and the only source of protection for a lot of people out here. So our whole community owes a huge debt of gratitude to Beatrice. And then a quick word about the way that the Connecticut Bail Fund has been able to work with SWAN. One of the issues that sex workers in our community face is criminalization. And a lot of times sex workers are profiled by the police, targeted, arrested, if not for prostitution, for other charges, because the police are profiling them as sex workers just for standing on the street. And so we've been really honored to partner with SWAN as the bail fund in order to bail people out so that we can make sure no one in our community is being incarcerated for doing sex work. We believe sex work should be completely decriminalized.
That was Brett Davidson, executive director of the Connecticut Bail Fund, preceded by Beatrice Codiani, co-founder of SWAN, the Sex Workers and Allies Network, both speaking at the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers rally in New Haven, Connecticut on December 17th. Learn more about the growing sex workers' rights movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Boston, Massachusetts, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KAOS in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Power of law and sex.
A powerful political figure asked several of his female staffers a favor. Either of you gals have my baby, don't worry, I'm willing to pay y'all. In an era in which sexual harassment, assault, and attacks on women seem commonplace, this case sounds like something out of a bad sci-fi movie. Is this real life? One wonders. It reminded me of the feminist futuristic classic The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, where men of money and means create a conservative theocracy where women of lower social standing are ordered and taught to serve the wealthy classes, even to the point of bearing them children, whom they then have no claim whatsoever. That, in fact, was the true and hidden condition of America at its founding, when African women were raped at will, only to give birth to children who could be sold for profit at whim. The politician who propositioned his staff members, Representative Trent Franks, Republican, 8th District, Arizona, was a prominent conservative known for family values. Well, this guy offered his staffers $5 million to sell their wombs. Some values, huh? Oh, he didn't want to use in vitro fertilization. He wanted to do it the old-fashioned way, you know, sex. Even though he's retired, doesn't it give you insight into how lawmakers think about regular people? I think so. The bodies of women are under capitalism's logic. Just another commodity, something to be bought and sold. That logic brought us the horrors and carnage of slavery, where black women were bred and sold like cattle. Over a century later, and the price has risen. Well, I guess that's progress, right? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Black minds matter. Her name is distinctly and deliciously black. A young scholar named Yanga Yamata Taylor has recently authored a book that promises to open eyes as well as minds. It's titled From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, put out last year from Haymarket Book in Chicago. In it, Taylor examines the violent impunity of the cops and their racist disdain for black life. The very thing sparked black rebellions across the 20th century, from Watts in California to Overtown in Florida. She charted the explosive growth of the Black Lives Matter movement and related organizations nationally. She also gives a failing grade to black politicians, for many of them had no idea how to respond to one of the most pressing problems facing black people, police terror. Her critique of black politicians show that they differ little from their white predecessors except for their color. For Professor Taylor, few so-called black political leaders, many of whom signed on to the mass incarceration train engineered by Bill Clinton, get a pass. Her work is thoughtful, honest, critical, and insightful. She does great credit to the scholar's art. Several years ago, law professor Michelle Alexander rocked the house with her remarkable book,
the new Jim Crow. Now, it's Kiangi Yamada Taylor's turn. From hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation from Haymarket. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. From the perspective of a cop, a helmeted, heavy-armed cop, who barks at the man on the floor who is clad in a t-shirt and shorts. The cop shouts, "Crawl to me, crawl!" The slightly chubby white guy is even whiter with fear, causing a tremor in his voice. "Please, don't shoot me." The cop tells him if he has to fall on his face, he'd better do so. A few seconds pass, and the tape abruptly stops. And as it does so, one hears a barrage of gunfire. We're hearing a man die, an unarmed man, a scared man. The cop? He was tried on charges of murder and manslaughter and acquitted of all. He resigned his position. So don't be surprised if he turns up elsewhere as a cop. A snapshot of America, 2017. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got another packed show for you this week, so let's just jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we'll hear an interview I did with Basilisa Alonso just the other day. Basi is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition, and she's helping to build support for and spread the word about seven dreamers and one supporter who were arrested and thrown in jail for occupying the offices of Senator Schumer and Congressman Corbello and demanding that they fight to get the DREAM Act passed in Congress or stop the passage of a major spending bill that is scheduled for a vote soon. The seven young dreamers are putting their lives and their future on the line, and it's imperative that people know about this and support them. And opening the show up, I'm very happy to welcome back to the show artist, cartoonist, and writer Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Dwayne Booth. And Fish is here to talk with us about his latest book, And Then the World Blew Up. That's right. And Then the World Blew Up. And it's a collection of cartoons, illustrations, personal essays, and culture war correspondence from an author who's just trying to defuse the apocalyptic bomb that is the miracle of our creation. Dwayne, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
Yeah, good. I didn't know that. I didn't know that that Mr. Fish was just a product, a result of your mother rejecting a name for a fish.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, okay. It was ridiculous. You know how when you're 19 and you're ready to save the world, you need a moniker that is not really your birth name?
Yeah. Yes, I'm familiar with that. Although in my family, it was usually idiot.
You're right. Oh, wait a minute. Mr. Idiot would have been a better moniker for me. Darn.
Yeah, there you go. Well, let's jump into this because I want people to get a taste of what's going on with this book and what's going on with you. And again, the book is Mr. Fish and Then the World Blew Up. Right. The title. Let's just to start in a warm, fuzzy way. What the hell is going on with that title?
Well, it's really funny because to me, it's an optimistic title. And the reason it's optimistic is that it assumes that the world hasn't yet blown up. You know, because sometimes I walk around and I say, you know, it's actually blown up and I'm sifting through the debris and desperately trying to see some optimism in the carnage around me. So to me, it says, okay, it's not blown up yet. It's coming. It's sort of a warning. But it actually came out of a story that my best friend from high school actually ended one of his short stories with. And this is back in the 80s. And I think he ended his story by saying, and then the world blew up, because he didn't have an actual ending for his story. And I told him I was going to steal it. And so decades later, I found the perfect time to steal it.
You know, I could have used that ending so many times in so many articles. How do I end this? How do I end this? It would have been so easy.
It makes sense to any equation, really, when you're talking about politics.
Yeah, you're talking about politics in the world today. Damn, man, come on.
Yeah. Well, that was what was interesting, too, about the book had a different title and it had a different opening because I was starting to put it together before Trump was elected. And then following the election, we needed a new way to open the book. And also, it colored the way the book was going, the narrative of the entire book. Because while the Trump phenomenon definitely has some real specific political tragic elements to it that are very blatant, I wanted to approach it too as an existential crisis. You know, I wanted it to reflect more on where we were as a species and what was going on with us as this collective. And so that's why if you look at the very first chapter in the book, it talks about my trip down to watch the inauguration and then participate in the march the next day. And I wanted to discuss that trauma in a poetic way.
Mm-hmm. And?
And that's what I did, because really, and that's what the other reason why the book is made up of so many personal essays, because I really think that, you know, while we're developing as younger people, our personal relationships, and even not even younger people, just how we are as people, are how we exist in our personal lives really determine how much engagement we're going to contribute to how we interact politically in a public space. And so that's why I wanted to look at my own demons, look at my own incongruities inside myself. I don't even know how to, because you might be a better judge on how that unfolds, you know, because I wrote these pieces once and then set them aside. And then during the edit, for the final edit of the book, when I reread them, I was like, oh, geez, I've exposed a way much more than I thought. I saw myself much more damaged than I previously thought. But it really informed my suspicion on authority figures and just the trajectory of my own political engagement.
Yeah, but, you know, it's interesting. And you can see that in the process of reading, going through the book and reading it. I mean, look, you know, I spent as much time reading the essays in your book that more than actually anything else you've ever produced, because, you know, I'm like reading that. And then it's a remarkable collection of, you know, just what is it, more than 400 pieces that you've done for this book. That's actually really incredible. And as usual, and even more so, given the conditions we're living in right now, the head-snapping effect of this is really intense. But when I saw the combination of all these essays about that start with, yes, you know, they tell stories from when you were growing up, and then they sort of segue quickly into a whole other what's happening now, and then they end up coming back to where you were in the beginning. And it really helps people understand, one, the process that – not just the process you go through, but the process that we're all living under too, because it puts all this stuff, all this insanity in a certain context that I think is really important for people to understand today.
Yeah, and that's what my hope was, because there's a quote in the book from a French philosopher. I can't remember his name right now, but it's in there. The quote is, "Our opinions become fixed at the point where we stop thinking."
Hmm.
Right. And so when I first read that, which was years ago, it made so much sense to me, because there's so many different distractions that enter into a person's life that stop them from, you know, further investigating certain ideas, cultural ideas, sexual ideas, political ideas. And so that's where they reside, and that's where they think the truth is. So when you have a society as ours is now becoming more and more contemptuous of critical thinking, people where they retard their thinking is starting to manifest itself in really, really dangerous ways for the culture. And it's not even an opinion. It's not even me saying, this is, you know, me, my theory is that things are really screwed up. All anybody has to do is look out the window.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if people know to engage in not just like the political turmoil, or the political revelry, if you're on that side of the aisle, people need to broaden their understanding of life by looking at clues that are inside, you know, inside the ecosystem, not in addition to the culture, to really test their own theories on what truth is. And we have to encourage ourselves to think beyond what we think we know. We got to go past our reflexive thinking when it comes to politics and culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that actually got me too is that when you do that, there's actually a lot of places that you do that. You do that in the essays, but then in the work as well. For some people, it's like, whoa, did he really say that? Or did he really draw that? Which is because I have to tell you, folks, this book. Now, Dwayne has done a lot of writing in this book. I think more writing than I've ever seen him do. Mm-hmm. And it's very deep, and it's very important to read that. But it's also the art in it is just stunning. It's stunning in just general terms, but it's also stunning in the way that it makes your head snap and say, damn, man, that's it, you know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that there are a number of pieces in the new book that took a really long time to do. There's a lot more, I would argue, serious fine art attempts at satire and commentary. And it really serves, you know, what we've been talking about. If you can get people to be shocked by something. I mean, it's really a job of satire anyway. You know, you want to sort of, you know, blow people's minds, right? You want to explode their preconceived notions, so then they have to put them back together again. And if you've done your job, they see that their previous notions don't fit comfortably together, and they have to, you know, reassess what they really think and feel about things. And one of the pieces that has gotten a lot of both praise and real serious pushback is at the beginning of the book, and it's my portrait of George Washington. It's a reworking of the famous, you know, oil painting that everybody knows. And what I ended up doing was removing his face to where it is just a very gory image.
It looks like a hand grenade exploded in his head. Okay.
Right. Yeah, and it took me a really long time to do, and it's also something that I find really uncomfortable to look at. Because while I know that I'm sort of defacing an iconic image for the purpose of satire, it's also done in such a realistic way that the visceral reaction to it is that it's stomach-turning. And it still is stomach-turning. But I think that that's what's important about it. You know, if you can connect an ideology or a way of thinking to something that is viscerally upsetting, which I think you can do when it comes to not only our foreign policy as a country, but also our domestic policy, if that's what requires people to then question the viability of how politics manifests themselves in this country and outside of this country, well, then that's necessary. Because as long as it stays just a conceptual conversation about my side says this, you know, it's a sports argument, then nobody's going to understand exactly what politics do to help or really hurt people.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Duane Booth, Mr. Fish, about his latest book, which is just a mind-blowing book. It's And Then the World Blew Up. Now, Duane, one of the things that you say here is that you talk about the idea that a subject is somebody saying that, you know, there's a subject that's it's just taboo. You can't do it. And you say that to you, the conventional interpretation of it is substandard somehow, and that the language with which to comprehend it has not been developed yet, that you think that there's no subject that really is taboo, basically, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah, because it's really – there's reality and then there's ways to interpret reality. And reality is indifferent to what we think about it. So, I mean, to say that that is taboo is sort of – it's an externality that we really don't have any control over. So it's silly. So what's left is our interpretation of these things. And these are sort of abstractions. They're connected to reality, but they're really sort of ideas. And if you start to suggest that there are ideas that are taboo, then it really cripples your ability to talk about things and then to comprehend things and then to really affect injustices, you know, to change certain things, right? The danger is keeping things hidden.
Yeah. Yeah. But then you also talk about a world where consensus equals wisdom or an approximation of the truth. And you said that the only thing that consensus equates is compromise. And I think that's really important. It's true for art, politics, religion, whatnot. But it's like that's an important concept to actually operate from as a base where consensus equals wisdom or an approximation of the truth. The only thing that consensus equates really is compromise, because people do. They look at it today. They look at it in what brought this monstrous creep, basically this thing that takes the history of fascism to a whole other level, Donald Trump. You know, people talk about, well, there was a consensus. And even if they talk about there's somehow consensus always fits in, we can look for ways to work it out. We can get a consensus here. We can actually have somewhat come together. And there's a couple places in the book where you have this sticking a hot knife into not butter, but into the people who are arguing for one way or another consensus.
Right. No, it's absolutely right. Because if you have – I mean, it's so easy to see. You can begin by explaining that concept to people – by asking them what their favorite color is, right? And they'll name their favorite color. And you will, you know, potentially have a different favorite color, and you'll know in your heart that your favorite color is actually the right color to be one's favorite. You'll judge them ever so slightly. So just imagine that sort of extrapolated into politics and sort of heavier issues, right? So the idea of consensus is creating this gray zone where nobody's exactly truthful. Because it's impolite to try to be very, very truthful if you're being contrary to people. So it's really for the sake of decorum and for the sake of our concept of what civility is, we've created these societies that are completely dishonest. Now, that's the public expression of that. Now, you get people alone at home, they're free to sort of say exactly what they think, and it's going to be contrary to how they behave in public. So my whole mission with this book, and generally my mission as an artist, is to try to bring these personal convictions much more into the light and much more into the public square, where they can be, you know, much more vigorously debated, and something closer to honesty can be exhibited. And also the understanding of, I hope that this came through in the book and what you're specifically citing, is the idea that truth is really circumstantial. You know, this idea that we can figure out how everything should exist and will exist forever, fair way, is such – it's a mythology that is very, very dangerous, because then you have to convene a committee to enforce those rules. And if we're talking about rules that were created by consensus, then everybody is numbed. Everybody is, you know, the vigorous honesty that people should be much more interested in engaging in is considered unuseful.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with Duane Booth, also known as Mr. Fish. And we're talking about the very important book that he just released, And Then the World Blew Up.
Well, yeah, and when you think about things about the rule of consensus, I mean, it's look, you know, consensus, I can't remember which comedian said it, but it was like there was a point where he said, wait a minute, you're going to let these idiots vote and decide what's going on over here? I mean, there really is this danger of, I mean, you end up with the witches' circles, you know, and the burning of witches in Salem and stuff. This is the kind of, and it's happening today. I mean, look at the way that, look at what's, you know, the kinds of things that are being done in terms of the blatant falsehoods, lies. You can't justify by saying they're misinterpretations. There's conscious lies and falsehoods that are being put out as truth because Trump spoke them and said they were truth. And he has all these yahoos voting for him and all this other stuff. And how many people believe something doesn't determine whether something is true or not.
Well, just even to speak to your point about voting, you know, the whole concept of democracy is a little bit more activity inside of a community beyond voting every 4 or every 2 years. That's a mythology that is extremely dangerous because the whole idea that we have this glowing, shining democracy because every few years we vote for a massive mediocrity or somebody who is extremely dangerous and we feel like we've done our duty in a democracy, that's not functioning as a democracy. You have to be politically active in between voting cycles. Because with voting cycles, what are you trying to do? You're trying to speak passionately and truthfully to a bureaucrat who then has to bring your concept of what should be going on as far as justice and peace is concerned to another bunch of bureaucrats. Moving the society forward, I really hope people start to recognize should be more than getting the right politely worded email into the right inbox.
It's heavy, though, because you look at this, and frankly, I mean, look, there's a search for truth. That's real. There are things that science can tell you about what's real, and they can explain the planets. They can explain the workings of, you know, inside this planet. They can cure diseases. They can work on curing diseases. They can measure the Earth where before, you know, everybody thought if you walked 20 miles, you'd fall off the edge of it, you know? And a lot of those people still are living, and in fact, some of them are in the White House, you know? You look at this, and you think about this, that how important it is to have a situation where people don't go by consensus, but they go by trying to really understand what's underneath it all. What's the bedrock of all this stuff? What's the thing that gives rise to all this? And I thought one of the things that I get from your artwork is that, and I hesitate, you know, it's funny. I always, every time we talk, I always have this problem because I hesitate to call it comics because it's actually deep art. But, you know, it's got such a great, just smacky in the head sense of humor. And the artwork is something that's like, it's astounding, and it also has a lot in common with people who grew up in that same general area that we grew up in, where after the 1940s and then into the 1970s and whatnot, and you're looking at this, there's a certain beauty to this that actually, one, displays all the frenetic uproar, but it also – there's a constant search for what's real and what's true and a mockery of what isn't.
Yeah, that's really well put because one of the things that I hope the book does is – confront and name this noise that is preventing people from really recognizing what the truth is, because that's what I see it as. I see it as noise. For example, let's talk about sharks for a second. This is a telling thing to me. I just found this statistic just a few weeks ago. We talk about sharks, and there's people, you go to the beach, and there's always something inside you where it's just like, this could be my day. The waters must be teeming with sharks, and it's just, I'm lucky if I get out without being bitten in half, right? There's this fear of sharks, right? So if you consider how many people on the entire planet are killed each year by sharks, it's between 10 and 20 people die in a year over the entire world by sharks. Do you know how many sharks are killed by human beings in a year?
No.
This is telling. Are you ready? This is insane. And it's a very similar statistic to what the numbers are for Native Americans that were killed by invading Europeans. It's a huge, there's a huge, huge range because just as it was with the indigenous population of the Americas over here, they were not seen as people. So you don't count them. You just slaughter them. They're like weeds, right? So as a result, the Indian population, they say it's between 8 or 114 million, because they just don't know. That's the range. With sharks, it's each year the range is between 63 million and 273 million sharks a year.
Boy. We're eradicating entire species without even naming them. If you flip those numbers, that's just as if sharks were responsible for killing the entire population, men, women, and children of France, England, Italy, and then Canada. You know, that's how brutal the slaughter is. So that's just that's just a metaphor for how we are not connected to who we are as a species and what is really going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we just don't know.
Yeah, and you're not even counting land sharks, right?
I am not counting the land sharks.
Or Dwayne has this one drawing in there of the Pope with his little hat on, his pointed hat. But his hat is actually an open-mouthed shark, it looks like.
Right.
Which I thought was really good. You know, I used to go to a beach in Maryland with my family when we were kids, and I always thought we were going to the beach. And, like, you know, I didn't have any concept of – I was a slow learner. I didn't have any concept of, like, the ocean and stuff. It was a river, right? And I kept telling my father I would be scared when a fish would hit me. And I said, but you don't know. It could be a shark. It could be a shark. And one time he just grabbed me and he pulls me out in the water and he says, there's no sharks in here. He says, if you want to be worried about anything, kid, look over there. You see that border over there, that land over there? That's where the military is doing all the testing of all these horrible drugs that are going to kill you, give you two heads, 7 feet, or rip your eyes out, melt your brain. And that's all that's dumping into the river we're swimming in. So worry about that. Don't worry about sharks.
Right. That's it. And it's a serious lesson, you know, that people should recognize.
Yeah, but it just added to my fears, okay? That's all it did.
Right.
Now I got sharks that are going, oh, no, it's not going to work. Now, Dwayne, tell me this, because there's a section of the book that I don't think I've seen you do this to the extent that you did it in this book, and that is there are these long conversations that they're often posed as you talking with a friend and da-da-da-da, but there's a lot of things that come up that are you. And it seems to me – now, I could be like way off base here, and you can just say shut up, okay? But it seems like you're actually voicing both, both people, that you're having this big, giant argument with yourself. And I understand where that comes from because there's so much concentrated in this. But it's also a situation where, as in all of your books – and like for instance, I'm looking at the one you have around Chomsky or supposedly with Chomsky. And in the end, I don't know whether it's worms or or cords or whatever, but the whole thing is everybody's just sort of kind of disappeared into this, just this huge morass of pink rope or something.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking, damn, man, there's something heavy going on here. But or maybe not. Maybe I was just like, that's how I explained everything. I don't quite understand it, though it's very heavy. Okay.
Yeah, it's my brain unraveling.
Right. Okay, there you go. There's an element to that. When I was looking at that, there's an element to that that occurs throughout the book. You actually put it in those things when people can see how you're actually wrestling with these questions. And then you go into that and it's your brain unraveling. But then it's also your brain unravels, but it opens up to all this other work that you go on and do, which is astounding, hitting at exactly the right contradiction and making people go, no, he didn't just say that, or laughing like crazy because you capture something right there that nobody can deny. The letters from the Peanuts characters are just astounding. I mean, and I just couldn't get into those characters, but when I saw them, I thought, okay, Charlie Brown basically tells Linus to go screw himself, basically, so I could grow up. And then Linus is writing a letter to corporate America saying, I'm out of here.
<It's> like, right.
But those are the kinds of things that really are unique about the way you approach everything. And the fact that these books are, and this is one of them that I think that I really value, the essays that are in it, as well as, though it didn't then mean that you didn't do the art, because you, like I said in the description of it, there's about 400 pieces that are there that really you go back to and back to again and again. So let's talk about that whole process a little.
Well, it's funny because the Chomsky conversation is real. There's only a couple things that I added just to get out of the scene with him. He obviously didn't beat anybody up. You know, that's part of the comic strip where that material appears. But the back and forth that we have about the viability of the arts community and its ability to engage politically is from a transcript from an interview that I actually did with him. And it was really interesting because I'm a huge fan of Noam, and I really wanting to talk to him about stuff that I had never heard him speak about. And so that's why I really like that part of the book, because if anybody reads his interviews and knows his work very well, I guarantee you'll find he and I engaged in some conversation you've never heard him engage in. So I was successful there. And as far as some of the other conversations that are in there, the ones that I can think of off the top of my head, I think there's an email exchange with my brother, which is real. There's an exchange between me and a friend, which it takes place in 1984, so it's only accurate to the point of it's the kind of conversations that we would have. I didn't record it. So the presence of other people inside the book, it's literally true where it can be literally true.
Mm-hmm. All right, I got it.
Yeah.
I'm writing that down so I can check it later, think about it, look it up, see what the hell you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about this guy, Dr. John Irving Bentley, because I have to say I thought, now I understand so much more about your art.
I know. Did you remember that picture from the past? I feel like everybody I've spoken to, I guess we should tell people what we're talking about.
Yes.
It was a picture from the 60s that I remember seeing in a magazine when I was very young. And it's a picture of a person's leg laying on the rug, basically, and a big burn spot where their body once was. And the whole debate about what that picture was, and it's a police picture, was, is it proof of spontaneous combustion? And the article where I read it when I was younger said that it was. It was a magazine that dedicated to paranormal activities, and this was just hardcore proof that there's a good chance that any one of us at any given moment will burst into flames and disappear, right? So as a child, trying to make sense out of that, you immediately have to go to some sort of divine intervention. You know, what was this person doing? And this person was a doctor. That's what was interesting to me. He wasn't a criminal. It didn't seem like he was being punished for anything. You know, he had a very benign little slipper on that foot that was left on the floor, you know. So I was just like, wow, what went on here? And then it made me go into this place where, is God reading our telepathy? And is he waiting for us to displease him where he will all of a sudden explode us, you know? And so as you see in the piece, I decide to test the theory of trying to offend God with my telepathy. And all of that is true. All of that is absolutely 100% true. And it was a real turning point for me.
Okay. You know, you're really lucky that you didn't go to Catholic school, because you would have been right up there in the stars of the school, man. It was like, you know, come on. Wow. So,
right.
There you go. He's proving God. Okay, there you are, man. There you are.
I feel like I told you this story in a previous conversation, either on or off the radio, but I do remember my one real solid attempt to understand the significance of religion and Christianity in particular. Gosh, I was probably six, maybe five, at Sunday school. And my older brother was really into religion and doing the right thing. So I was like, man, I just can't figure this out. It doesn't make sense to me. Until all of a sudden, sitting there, I was like, oh, I had an epiphany where I'm like, I think I can have this make sense. And I remember raising my hand, and the Sunday school teacher said, yes. I said, I think I've got this figured out. She said, oh, really? What did you figure out? And I said, Santa Claus is Jesus as an old man. And I got such pushback and was considered, it was like a really dangerous thing to say. And that's when I was just like, all right, I'm out. I'm never going to understand any of this.
And if you had been in Catholic school, there would have been children assigned to build crosses in the parking lot. Right? There you go. We'll show you.
Right. And for extra credit, nail yourself to it.
Right. Exactly. I wanted to talk about a couple things. I mean, I've always enjoyed your books really a lot and enjoyed talking with you in all the wackiness and all the things that actually – I don't want people to forget this point that actually your work is extremely significant. And you talk about you worry because you don't see any real significant artwork being produced generally nowadays to help deepen our understanding of recent historical events beyond whatever sound bites were given by a 24-hour news cycle.
Right.
And then you also talked about how humor, in your mind, humor often derives much of its potency from simple truth-telling, a comedic snap coming from the shock that the average person experiences when confronted with sheer honesty. And I'd like to talk about those two things now.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. It's really, just think about what the appeal of a joke is. A joke gives you permission to think outside the box. You have to. You have to do that in order to have the joke make sense. And then the joke will really only make sense if, A, it adheres to actual logic in the world or its own logic. You're building a mechanism, right? And the mechanism has to function to make sense. So all of that is just an attempt to, it requires you to forgive alternative point of view, dissent from the mainstream for the sake of getting to the punchline, which people want to hear. So it's just a moment where you can actually be an outlaw yourself, and you'll be much more open to ideas. It's a way to get controversial ideas into people's heads and then into their mouths when they retell it to somebody else as a proof that things shouldn't be taken as seriously and made taboo, like we were talking about earlier. And it's true that I feel like when it comes to artistic expression, it requires a little more time than what you were saying is, you know, the 24-hour news cycle. And really skim broadcasting, which I think is really how news is disseminated now. You know, people get their news in sound bites, and they get it. They don't go deep with any concept. So therefore, you don't need to know any history. Mm-hmm. You don't need to know anything. You're just there to react to the news. And art demands something a little bit more. And I think that just as truth requires more, you know, to understand anything, you need to spend some time with it. And you also need to spend some time with it inside your own mind without the distraction of just hearing it from somebody else. And those precious time, those precious moments of being able to sort of sit inside your own mind to test the validity of different thoughts and ideas is fast going away.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is going to be the last question, the last thing we have time for. And it has to do with brings two things together. There's one, a question I have about the challenge of doing your art in a world like today where insanity and piggishness abound, but they sort of rule generally in a society. But then there's also the fact that what you've talked about, or what I've looked at in what you've done, the last chapter of your book, which actually the other chapters are great and they bring together tremendous things both visually and philosophically and understanding and all this other stuff. But then you get into this last chapter, and it's very sharp in terms of going after. I mean, even the way it opens up with this one picture of – and I'll figure out what the hell – and you don't use hell, but what the hell would big black pissed off Jesus do? But then it goes on and it goes on. You have Obama beating on with a dog, Martin Luther King. You have Obama with a Caesar's head, you know, crown on and thumbs down, and you have Trump. You rake Trump across the coals a dozen times. This is an extremely, I mean, just really a very powerful thing. And I'd like to talk about just that, the way you actually bring that all together in those final pages of this.
It's really the crescendo. You need a denouement that makes sense when you're talking about all of this material. And it was just important to me, again, to echo the sentiment that we're precious and we're vulnerable beings. And to have that resonate, I needed to expose myself as a precious and vulnerable human being and hope that that tone resonates with people who I hope are enjoying this in a private space and allowing themselves the grace of being able to deliberate on the conversation that I want people to have.
Okay. So I shouldn't be continue doing mine and reading it on the bus and laughing out loud and telling people, hey, did you hear this? Okay. I can do that. Come on. I thought that was helping you out, buddy. All right. Dwayne, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, man.
Yeah,
always a pleasure to talk with you, and we'll have to continue this because it's and when you come out here, we'll have to have you come up on the show live, all right?
Yes, I will absolutely do that, and yes.
Okay, great. All right, Dwayne, talk to you again soon, man.
Thanks, Michael.
Take care. All right, that was Mr. Fish, or as he's otherwise known, Dwayne Booth. See, we give him equal treatment here. And we were talking about his new book, and then the world blew up. The book is published by Fantagraphics, and for more on the book and Mr. Fish's cartoons, check out his website, clowncrack.com. Once again, that's clowncrack.com. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
that was Outer National with Todos Somos Ilegales, We Are All Illegals. In September, Trump announced his decision to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, the Obama-era program that kept undocumented immigrants who'd been brought to the United States as children from being deported. Now, seven DACA recipients were arrested in the offices of Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Representative Carlos Corbello, demanding that they, along with other members of Congress who previously expressed support for Dreamers, live up to their word. The DACA recipients are demanding that members of Congress block any spending bill that does not include a Clean Dream Act. Here to talk with us about this is Bossy Lisa Alonso, who's a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition. Bossy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Sure, and I want to start off by saying that someone called me and said, man, have you seen this? This is so important. There's so much on the line here, and there's so much bravery, and it's something that people everywhere have to pay attention to, respect, and actually think about what it means for them in the conditions we're living in today. So that's why I wanted to talk with you about this action. So why don't you tell us about the recent action that was taken by these seven students and others who are DACA recipients?
Sure. So on Friday, seven undocumented youth and one ally went to Senator Schumer's office and Representative Corbello's office. The reason why they went there was because these are two people, especially Senator Schumer, you know, who has positioned himself to be a leader and who has multiple times said that he stands with Dreamers. But just last week, he was already backtracking on that and saying that the Dream Act could be brought up for a vote later on. That's something that, you know, is totally different than what he has been saying up until a few days ago. And these really brave people took action because we're asking that this issue no longer gets kicked along down the road, right? We've been waiting for over 10 years. This has been a long time in the making. People are losing their status every single day, about 120 people, and we just can't wait right now. And if they say that they stand with Dreamers, then we need them to prove it.
Now, when you said that it's a very dangerous situation for people right now, why?
Because people are already losing their status. So there are about 120 DACA recipients every day that lose status. As we are seeing with our brave comrades that are in jail right now, DACA is no longer a guarantee protection. ICE has been alerted about one of our colleagues in jail and puts the entire group at risk. So ICE could potentially detain them. Every day that they spend in jail heightens the risk of ICE intervening and perhaps detaining them. And, you know, this is something that can be fixed, right? All we're asking is that Senator Schumer and Representative Corbello come out and publicly pledge that they have the votes necessary to stop any spending bill that doesn't include the DREAM Act.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, because actually, I mean, there's a lot of times in what I've been reading about it since yesterday, the day before, it really hit me a lot that there's a question here of when you talk about what the congressional people are saying, what the system is saying to people is very different than what people are actually, what the youth and the other people, the Dreamers, are actually demanding. And there's a certain amount of righteousness that's really important that's on the side of the people. And there's a certain amount of, you know, just dishonesty and, you mm-hmm. know, just flim-flamming on the side of the system. Let's talk about that a little bit, about the way mm-hmm. that's fallen out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. This is something that we are told some things privately, we're told some things publicly. But essentially, what we want is for something to happen already. It's never been our time, right? This issue has never, it's never been the right time for any type of immigration bill to come up. The last time we had any sort of immigration relief was in 1986. And we really just can't wait. We need the DREAM Act now to protect everyone who is losing status. And we always knew that DACA was only a temporary fix, right? Because that was something that we have to renew every couple of years. And we knew that there was always a possibility that if a president was in office who didn't have the same views as President Obama, could revoke that at any time, like it has happened. Politicians have told us, especially Democrats, that they are on our side. And this is something that we're constantly told, we have been told for many, many years, that we should focus on Republicans. But let's not forget that in 2010, the DREAM Act failed because five Democrats didn't vote with their party. And so we just want to make sure that everyone remembers that and that no one forgets that, and that Senator Schumer actually whips his party to not vote for the spending bill if it doesn't include the DREAM Act, And we also need his guarantee that he has the votes necessary to make this happen, to make the DREAM Act happen this week.
You know, that's one of the things that actually really impressed me, is that it seemed to me that what you folks were saying from the get-go was sort of, look, we've played around with these politicians. This is not something that we can continue to play with, that this is a very serious matter for many, many. I mean, look, we're talking about how many hundreds of thousands of people are.
800,000.
Yeah, yeah. And this is something that really has got to be resolved, because this is a massive crime against humanity when they're talking about going in and just rolling down the tracks and deporting people. I mean, just picking them up. And it really can. People don't think about this. It really can go from what it is today, where you're having deportations that are sort of, you know, behind the screen. Sometimes they burst out, but it's actually kind of quiet and nobody's really focused on a lot of it, to when you're actually having railroad cars filled with people and deporting them.
And that's something that they can't turn away from, right? What happened on Friday, we're showing them this is what's going to happen. This is going to be our reality if nothing is fixed. Right. And we're also asking that we get the DREAM Act, but with no negative attachments. We don't want any money for Border Patrol. We don't want money for the wall. We don't want our communities to be criminalized, because my parents are not criminals. My parents are the original dreamers. And so we want the DREAM Act, but not at the cost of our families. And that's something that they can't turn away from. Senator Schumer, Representative Corbello, and the rest of Congress will go home and spend a very lovely time with their family for Christmas. But our families, that's not going to be the case. A lot of us go home every single night and don't know if we're going to see our families the next day. And that's the reality that we live in. And I know it's hard for someone who doesn't understand the reality that we live in to wrap their heads around, but that's what's happening. And the fact that seven people are sitting in DC jail right now and who have been exposed to ICE, that's just a reality that Congress can't push aside. They have to face that, because they were arrested and they're in D.C. jail for simply asking that Senator Schumer really prove that he is the leader he says he is and that he really stands with dreamers. And the same thing with Representative Corbello, who says that he stands with dreamers.
Now, you've said a couple times that ICE has already been alerted as to the presence of these youth in jail and that the protesters could be deported. They could actually be picked up right now without even, you know, just them walking in and getting deported like that?
So I'm not sure how the legality works, but we know that ICE is aware of one of our colleagues who is in jail right now. So they have the ability to request that once they are released from jail, that they be detained, right? That they be held for ICE pickup. And they can be transferred to a detention center, and that entire process will just be triggering their immigration hold and could possibly put them in deportation proceedings.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you think about this, and it really stunned me, that this is actually a fast-moving machine, as you've been indicating. But just so people know, 11,000 people have lost their status so far, and every day 122 more people lose their DACA status. So every day without DACA actually threatens deportations for hundreds of people, literally, right?
Absolutely, yeah. As soon as we lose our status, we are exposed to deportation, right? And that is especially dangerous for people at border towns because of the interaction with Border Patrol. One thing that Senator Schumer seems to forget is that New York is a border town, right? We border Canada. So there's plenty of people, plenty of farm workers who get deported all the time from interaction with Border Patrol. So losing our protection is horrible, but the other thing is also that we won't be able to work anymore. This is going to be one of the most, a massive layoff, if you think about it like that. We have 800,000 people who are no longer going to be able to work to contribute to society and provide for their families.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about the impact on people's families beyond the providing for their families? But what about the impact on people, like, you know, if some students are picked up and deported and or just picked up by ICE or whatever, and they're run out like this? What is the impact on the families that are left behind? Is it, do they then become, you know, susceptible to ICE and all these and deportations and whatnot?
Mm-hmm. And we simply don't know, right? The government said, come out, come forward, come out of the shadows. We're going to grant you this protection. Don't be afraid. We won't use your personal information against you. But we don't know if that's going to be true or not, right, with this administration. This administration could potentially utilize the information that we use when we apply for DACA to go after us and our families.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us this. You know, when you're talking about the people being in jail and all this, it really struck me that there was something, I read some stuff about, it wasn't just people getting arrested like you normally get arrested in a demonstration. You're arrested and then you're, you know, you might be booked on a minor charge, you might be let out and then you go to court later, something like this. But this was actually, people were actually thrown in jail and they made a decision that morally and politically, they were not going to bend to the rules. And they've been undertaking a lot of actions, I understand, in the jail themselves, right?
Mm-hmm. So they were arrested on Friday. Today is the fourth day that they spent in jail. They have also been engaging in the hunger strike. So their bellies are empty, but we know that they've said that their hearts are full with the strength of the community. We are showing up to show them that we are there, that we stand with them. But again, they can come out tomorrow, right? All we need is Senator Schumer and Representative Curbelo to do their job.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Basilisa Alonso, who is a volunteer with the Our Dream Coalition. And we're talking about a very courageous and important stand taken by 7 DACA recipients and one other volunteer to stand up and say that they demand that DACA be reinstated now. As I was thinking about this and as I was thinking back about what we've just been talking about, you know, I don't want to let these people off the hook. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about the hypocrisy of the Democrats. You have Schumer and all these people, and there's a certain amount of a real the stench of hypocrisy surrounding everything they're doing in relation to this. Let's talk about that a little.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I come from New York, and when people think of New York, they think of New York City and its, you know, welcoming policies towards immigrants. But I grew up right outside of New York in Westchester County, which is, you know, a little more conservative. And I think that people don't really see New York as a place that's hostile to immigrants, but, you know, anything outside of New York City can be a hostile place. We've been told throughout this very long journey that now is not our time. It's never been our time. Immigration has never, it's never been the right time to do something about immigration. When it's midterm years, they say we can't do that because, you know, it's going to harm Democrats who are running for re-election. For example, when President Obama came in, he said that immigration was going to be his priority. Latinos came out in support because, you know, in addition, yes, to education, to health care, he said he was going to do something for us, and he didn't. We were put on the back burner, and they said, wait, now is not your time. In 2010, when we lost the DREAM Act because of 5 Democrats, they said it was because of the re-elections, right? They were facing tough re-elections. But we're with you, and we'll do something. And then when DACA happened, you know, that was from pressure from our community. We had people sitting in President Obama's re-election offices to bring attention to the fact that he hadn't kept his promises. And so he gave us DACA, but because of the work that the community put in. And then we wanted something more permanent, right? Because we knew that, in a sense, that was just breadcrumbs. But again, they told us, now is not your time. Now here we are in 2017, and we have an administration who is revving up their deportation machine, who they're deporting people indiscriminately. And they're telling us again, this is not the time. So then when is the time? If we couldn't do it under a Democratic president when we had the majority in both houses, and now we can't do it now with a president who is coming after me and my family, then when is the time? We can't wait anymore.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what kind of response have you been getting among people that hear about this? Have there been people coming up to support?
Yes, we have been receiving an outpouring of support from the community. There's been more DACA recipients who are just inspired by this big sacrifice that these 7 people and one ally are taking. They're literally putting their livelihood on the line. And that's just something really inspiring. And it's a shame, frankly, that 7 people have to risk deportation in order to move leaders in Congress, right? I really wish that Congress could just have a quarter of the strength that these people are showing right now.
Hmm. Well, that'd be, there's a big, long, hard wish. You're not going to see, sister. I got to tell you that, okay? That's just not going to happen. But here's the thing, because overall, when I heard about this, I was very moved. And I thought, here are people whose their freedom, their safety, their very lives are at threat here. If they
Absolutely.
Dare to stand up and do this, their lives are at threat. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about that because it's like there's an overall importance of this action saying this at this time under this regime. And we have a fascist regime in power. And to stand up against them like this is not only brave, but extremely important in terms of the example it sets for people everywhere else. Let's talk about mm-hmm. that, the overall importance of this action in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And why people took it now.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that these folks are giving us is hope that we can stand up and we can fight back, even under this administration. We may not be able to vote. We may not be able to pay, you know, high-powered lobbyists, but we have the power of our stories, and that's what they're using, right? And they're using their stories in hopes to motivate the American public to stand with us. Because we can't do this alone. We need both affected community members and our allies to stand with us. We need congressional representatives to realize that my friends right now have been in jail for 4 days now. ICE knows about them. And this is something that they can end. Like, we're just asking that they finally do their job after 2 decades.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about stories, and I think that's very important as well. Let's talk about that. When you say their stories actually can impact people, give people a sense of what those stories are.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, we have one person who is very young. Her parents are undocumented. They're both farm workers. They work from sundown. They get treated unfairly. Their job is backbreaking. But here she is, you know, speaking up for herself and speaking up for her family. And just taking that risk because she knows that even if something happens to her, even if she has to suffer for a week and to get Congress to act, what we're going to get is hopefully protection for her, but not at the expense of her parents, her migrant farm working parents.
Mm-hmm. When you say that, I was thinking about that as well. And some of it is when you think about what is it that motivates people overall? Because this is not, it's not an easy step to take. I mean, people are stepping out of whatever way that they've been able to sort of make their way through this society, faced with the removal of the Dreamers Act, all this other stuff, and Trump's moves to deport people. All of these things, yet people keep doing this. And that's one of the reasons I was really so, I think it's so important for people to understand what people are facing and the fact that in the face of all that, that they have the heart and the soul and the thinking, mm-hmm. the broadness of mind and the dedication to actually stand up against this regime and the horror that it's bringing down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a saying, you know, when they take everything away from you, they even take your fear. That's a saying, you know, very popular in Latin America. We've been pushed to the brink where our backs are against the wall. We are at this point laying all our cards on the table. We are, you know, asking, like laying our hearts bare. We are saying, you know, we need your help. We need the American public to make those calls, to hold their members of Congress accountable. And we need our undocumented community to stand up. We're not going to let them drive us back into the shadows. Like, that's what they're going to do. We've been able to come out of the shadows. DACA was a win from the community, right? We won DACA because we had people, like the people sitting in jail right now, who risked a lot. Even with no protection against deportation, they participated in civil disobedience, and they were arrested, and they could have been deported. But they put everything on the line to fight for all of us, for all the 800,000 people who have DACA, and for all their families.
Mm-hmm. And that part about for all their families and all the people that aren't their families but are part of their bigger family, because I know this is one thing I read in connection with this, is that it was said that this isn't just about the permanent protections for undocumented youth, but actually people are acting for all 11 million undocumented people in the U.S. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Mm-hmm. Just to put things into perspective a little bit, I am also a DACA recipient. And the day that DACA was announced in 2012, I was coming home from my waitressing job. I was in college, working three jobs, trying to finish school. I didn't know what I was going to do. After I graduated from school, I thought that I was going to have this diploma, this pretty diploma, and just hang it on the wall and not be able to do anything with it. And I got home that day, and my mom very excitedly came in. And she was like, you have to come watch TV. You know, President Obama is going to make an announcement about Dreamers. And she was really excited. And I remember being in the room with her and my father, and we were watching the television. And as President Obama came out, you know, my mom, who has broken English, you know, was clinging onto every word. And then he started mentioning the things that would qualify people for DACA. And in my head, I was just doing a mental checklist, like, yes, I qualify for this. You know, I made the deadline. I made the cut. And after the press conference was over, we all just, you know, started crying, and we all hugged each other. And then I had an immense sense of guilt where I said, you know, it doesn't feel right that I get this protection and that you don't. And my mom said, I don't care what happens to me. All I care is that you're okay and that you're safe. And that's what we're fighting for. They're not criminals. You know, my parents are the original Dreamers. They came here escaping violence to give me a better life. And like my family, there are hundreds of thousands of other families just like that. So we're saying, you know, we deserve this protection. We've grown up here. This is our home. But at the same time, we're not willing to jeopardize the livelihood of our families.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One last question. What's happening now through Friday, and how can people plug in?
Yeah, for anyone that, you know, wants to stand up, wants to plug in, visit fightforourdream.org. Again, that's fightforourdream.org. Follow us using the hashtags OurDream and CleanDream, and stand up and host something in your district. If you can't come to D.C., host a vigil for acknowledging the sacrifice that these DACA recipients are taking. Hold a sit-in in your congressional representative's office. Hold them accountable. Let them know that this is an important issue to you, the voter, and that we can't wait for the DREAM Act. This is the best time for us to get something. This is the best time where we have some leverage to get the Clean DREAM Act. And we know that if the DREAM Act gets brought up in February or in January, then it's not going to be anything good. It's going to contain a lot of things that's going to be harmful to our communities. We're tired of playing politics. If you are going to let us be taken away silently in the night, you know, there's a saying that you can judge a country by how they treat their homeless, by how they treat their prisoners, by how they treat the people who are the most marginalized. And we are those people. So if you're not going to fight for us and they come for us, and once they're done with us, they're going to come for you.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And there's a big question about where the hell is your humanity? That's mm-hmm. huge. All right, Bossy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here again.
Yeah. And listen, let's stay in touch because I want to follow this as it works out. All right.
Okay. Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you. Take care now.
Okay. Bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Bossy Lisa Alonzo. And Bossy is a volunteer for the Our Dream Coalition. And we've been talking about the recent move by seven Dreamers to stand up and demand that Congress pass the DREAM Act immediately. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank my two guests, Dwayne Booth and Bossy Alonzo. For websites mentioned on today's show, check my Facebook page or my website, which is themichaelslateshow.com. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op, Teddy Robinson, and all of you who tune in each and every week and stay tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little more from Todos Somos Ilegales by Outer National. Talk to you again next week. I dream of fire.